Neptun Zettel zur Parlamentsreise.
Then do is firstly to let me just alter my order now very fast. I want to start in the following order. Let us see, I'm not yet in here. It's not Merry Christmas. Deputy Chairperson of the FFC. Let's then welcome the firstly the Deputy Chairperson of the FFC, Mr. Khumalo. Compliments of the new year, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Chair.
And the members of my committee. You look nice and trim.
Thank you,
Jim. Are you ready? Are you ready for our new assignment?
I'm
looking for a lot, Jim. Okay. Let me welcome then the special delegates. Special welcome to the special delegates that we have here from the Free State, Mr. Nodir, from Limpopo, Gateway to Africa. Castel, and I think it's a very useful discussion that we are going to engage in. Let me also then welcome the Secretary of Parliament, Mr. Tingani, the Accountant General. I'm also happy he's here because it's just a pity. I'm just saying it's a pity that Auditor General is not here, Auditor General's office. But I'm also happy now that the FFC is here. So what I want us to do is just to plunge the Secretary of Parliament first, and then take the FFC, and then take the Accountant General. Shift in terms of the issues that are before us. The issue really that does worry me myself as a, and I think us as a committee, is the fact that we want to appear as a federal country. And I think the discussion therefore that we must engage in must seek to strengthen the fact that we are not a federal country, that we are a unitary country. And so as we deal with this piece of legislation, these are some of the nuances we pick up ourselves as a committee. And so clearly it is a piece of legislation that we think is critical, needs to be reflected upon very, very critically, so that as you finally pass it, you don't create a banana republic if you like. That's the fundamental angle from which we engage as a committee ourselves. We're not sure why some other people seem to take this engagement lightly. We've had, for instance, Mr. Sokoni can tell you that his speaker says, well, this is not a big deal. And I've met some two or three speakers somewhere also seem not to think it's a big deal. Whereas from where we sit at, we are really thinking it's a big deal for us to avoid inadvertently creating a federal country, whereas the country is unitary. And so, having then said that, the discussion must then warrant that kind of seriousness. We don't want to pass this for the sake of it. Some people want us to do that. We don't want to go that route. We could have done it long time ago, but precisely because we are a national council of provinces whose mandate is very clear. And so as we deal with this one, we're very much mindful of the fact that we don't want to create problems for provinces, for instance, and so on and so on. And we shall then, I think at the end, raise some fundamental questions for consideration. Questions that we think remain very, very fundamental and big. I'd ask for the presiding officers to be here. They are not here. They've sent the secretary. I did meet with Mr. Masangu last week, and he did say that the secretary of parliament would be representing them. Of course, firstly, he would then represent the POs, but secondly, he would then respond also. He also has a submission that is before us as secretary of parliament. I did raise some of the issues with Mr. Masang, and he did say to me that they do not want to influence us as a committee. He also does not have answers for some of the big issues that we were raising. And so it's a matter that we shall throw back to the Secretary of Parliament. I've also called for the State Law Advisor's Office to be here. We are also throwing something to them. There is also a legal opinion which we think is kind of one-sided, because it was not looking at the issues we are raising ourselves. It was looking at another angle from the point of view of the Portfolio Committee. And that angle was the constitutionality of the bill. Does not look at the questions that we have picked up ourselves. We might want to go back and look for that kind of a legal opinion too. But our first port of call would be the State Law Advice Office in Parliament. And, Now, having then said that and welcomed everybody, and I hope that all of us had a wonderful festive season, ready and raring to go. Let me then, I see here is a presentation from, let's then allow firstly the Secretary of Parliament to take us through his own submission. Over to you, Mr. Dingaan.
Thanks, Chairperson. For this opportunity to address the committee on the matter that we have raised. Chair, perhaps one needs to preface one's comments and with an acknowledgement of the fact that this bill has indeed improved a lot over a long period of time of interaction with the committees of parliament, that the points that we raise now are important, more so with regards to how this bill, as and when it becomes an act, would be implemented. There are a few issues that we want to raise, about three indeed, mainly. One can also just point out to the fact that the Joint Rules Committee adopted the governance model way back in 2004, I think, if I'm not mistaken, on the 18th of November 2004. And that governance model was put in place precisely to separate as dictated by Section 45 of the Constitution. Because you would see that in the past, there used to be, during the first and the second parliament, there used to be a confusion of roles in that area. You'd find that the Joint Rules Committee would get involved in the matters of running the institution. Whereas the Joint Rules is expected to be giving policy directives insofar as the joint business, core business of Parliament is concerned. So therefore, the Joint Rules agreed to establish that governance model. That governance model comprises the Speaker of the National Assembly, the Chairperson of the NSOP and their deputies. It also comprises the Chief Whip of the majority party, the Chief Whip of the largest minority party, the two representatives that are drawn from the minority parties in Parliament. Secretary to Parliament serves in that structure as an ex officio member. It is that body, and once that was adopted by the Rules Committee and agreed to, the two Houses of Parliament adopted the governance model, both the National Assembly and NCOP. I am telling that story, Chairperson, deliberately to say, to indicate why I would want to raise certain issues here, which appear not to be taking into account the fact that there's a governance model called the Parliamentary Oversight Authority, established through the Joint Rules Committee, and both houses agreed to that. And so the bill needs to make a recognition of the fact that there's that governance structure in Parliament. Chair, this is a multi-party forum established by the Reserve, as I said at the beginning. Whose role is to ensure policy implementation by giving an indication of the level and extent of the required services and facilities for Parliament and monitoring their implementation. Subject to the policy directives of the POA, the Secretary and other officials prepare the budget of the institution. And that budget is therefore referred to what is referred to as the Budget Council, comprising once more of members of Parliament drawn from the various political parties in the institution. And that model has been working very well, Chairperson, from 2004 up to date. The Speaker and the Chairperson of the NSOP submit the budget to National Treasury in the manner as would be required in terms of the bill, that's Section C-Clause 17.2. Therefore, it appears as if the bill institutionalizes the current procedures for budget preparation. However, Clause 4 of the bill establishes a joint committee and sets out its composition and functions in some detail. Neither the executive authority, namely the Speaker and the Chairperson of the NSOP, nor the Deputy Speaker and the Deputy Chairperson of the Council may be members of the joint committee. The functions of the committee include both considering the drafts of the strategic plan, annual performance plan, budget, and adjustments budget. In other words, overseeing the budget preparation process and oversight of the performance of the use of Parliament funds. It is our view, Chair, that in this way the bill creates a role for the executive authority to merely table the budget, a role that is devoid of any responsibility for preparing the budget. However, It also provides that the executive authority is accountable to Parliament for sound financial management. It also provides that the accounting officer is accountable to both the Joint Committee and the Executive Authority. But in the same bill, you've got a clause, I think, which puts the responsibility for preparing the budget on the presiding officers. So there's a contradiction in the same bill itself. There is an acceptance in the bill that the Executive Authority is responsible for overseeing the preparation of the budget. But somewhere, it gives the responsibility to the committee, of the Joint Committee. So I think that we need to correct that anomaly in the bill. It is thus peculiar that once it appears that the bill institutionalizes the current practice of budget preparation, it obscures the responsibility for preparing the budget. Effectively, this ambiguity undermines
the purpose of the bill to enhance accountability for the financial management of the Parliament by failing to define responsibilities
and accountability for preparing the budget clearly. In my opinion, the Joint Committee should not have the responsibility set out in clause 4.1a(b) and 17.1. I may just refer you to those clauses, Chair, for effect. Clause 4.1a and B. A Joint Committee of Parliament must maintain oversight of the financial management of Parliament by, among other things, A, considering drafts of the strategic plan, annual performance plan, budget, adjustment budget, and draft revisions to the approved allocations from Parliament's own funds that are submitted to Parliament in terms of Section 17, and B, considering the strategic plan, annual performance plan, and budget tables in Parliament in terms of Section 17.1. And so Section 17.1. It's on page 10 of the bill. The executive authority must still in Parliament for referral to the Joint Committee the draft strategic plan of Parliament within 10 working days of receiving it from the accounting officer, and all those points that appear under 17, so up to D. So I'm saying that those responses should not be given to the Joint Committee, as it is called in the bill, because those indeed belong, those are the responsibilities of the executive authority. But we still agree, Chair, that there is a role for a committee to play. But that role is that of exercising oversight over that work and not be responsible to oversee the preparation of the budget. Because it can't be. But there are other people constitutionally who've got to do that. That's the presiding officers. I therefore suggest, Chair, that the Select Committee remove these clauses from the bill and make the necessary consequential amendments. As indicated above, the bill deals sufficiently with the budget preparation in clauses 13 and 17.2. It will also be mentioned that the detail in clause 4, namely specifying the establishment, composition, and function of the Joint Committee, unnecessarily limits the constitutional authority of the Houses to determine and control their respective internal arrangements, proceedings and procedures. Although this level of detail for the purpose of maintaining oversight is appropriate in some instances, for example, instances pertaining to national security, as is the case in the oversight of the intelligence service by the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, it would be more appropriate in the case of maintaining oversight of Parliament financial budget to require Parliament to establish a mechanism. In that way, Parliament can, from time to time, determine which is the best mechanism, instead of being dictated to in law as to the mechanism. It can always agree which mechanism it wants to use. Such requirement would be consistent with the wording of the Constitution, sir, which requires the establishment establishment of mechanisms to maintain oversight. Similarly, the Public Audit Act 25 of 2004 provides that a mechanism to maintain oversight over the Auditor General must be established. I therefore suggest that the bill should follow these examples and require that Parliament establish a mechanism instead of a joint committee to maintain oversight of the financial management of Parliament, including the consideration of the report of the Auditor General on financial statements of Parliament. And for the purpose of other reports, allegations and instructions as provided for in the bill. Here we refer to both the joint rules, and I want to add that the POA, that both the joint rules committee and the POA would be the appropriate mechanism, structures, to provide the details of this mechanism. It should also be remembered, sir, that it is Parliament that must maintain oversight of the financial management and not a committee. A committee is merely a tool in the hands of Parliament. At times we make the mistakes, sir, even when departments come and report. People make the mistake to think that departments, government departments come to report to committees. They actually report to Parliament. Ministers are accountable to Parliament. But those committees are merely a mechanism for functionality of the institution. And we make that mistake many times, many times. The second area, say, is the space, what we call the space for innovative and creative management. Now, I must explain what we mean by creative here. We're not talking about creative accounting at all. But that there needs to be space for management to be creative in managing the institution. And if you read the PFMA's and members with respect, you'd find that one of the key tenets of the PFMA is to allow managers to manage, give that space. And I'm saying that we somewhat take away that in this bill, and I'll point out those areas. The bill sets out the general financial management functions of the accounting officer in clause 7, most of which appears to be borrowed from the Public Finance Management Act 1 of 1999. Like the PFMA, failing to comply with these provisions in a deliberate or grossly negligent way constitutes a criminal offense and is punishable. Such consistency between the bill and the PFMA is, of course, in line with the constitutional principle of cooperative government, which requires that all spheres of government must provide effective, transparent, accountable, and coherent government for the Republic as a whole. It also answers your question that you raised at the beginning. But we are not dealing here with the federal state. We are dealing with the entire state. And that also in Parliament, we believe in the single coherent financial management framework of the country. We believe in that. We don't want to create separate frameworks altogether. And I think that this further speaks to that. However, clauses 7E and F, which provide for performance management of parliamentary officials and training and awareness programs related to financial management of officials, respectively, do not have similar provisions in the PFMA. While the purpose of these provisions is laudable in terms of management philosophy, placing such requirements in legislation subject to criminal sanction begs the question as to the mischief Parliament intends to address with these. This question must be considered by the Select Committee. And all we're saying is that please leave these things to management. I mean, any manager worth his salt would make sure these things are done. That is, there's training for managers, but you don't have to put that thing in law. Provisions such as 7E and F are management principles. In light of the detailed provisions pertaining to the performance of the accounting officer, it would be in the interest of the accounting officer to apply these principles, amongst others. However, compelling the accounting officer by way of statutory obligations and imposing criminal sanctions create the impression that the accountant also is only required to implement these obligations. The effect is that creative and innovative management is discouraged. For the reasons set out above, I suggest, with respect, that clause 7E and F are inappropriate and should be removed. The third point, implementation of certain provisions pertaining to the supply chain management. Clause 46 of the bill prohibits Parliament from contracting with specific persons or entities to provide for goods and or services to Parliament. Our main takes around this, and members of Parliament, around this area, is the difficulty with which you would administer that. I think that any law, simplicity of administration is the best tenet of any law. It's going to be highly difficult to administer and monitor the implementation of this law, of this bill, as and when it becomes law. The prohibition applies: a member of Parliament, a member of the Cabinet, a member of the Provisional Legislature, a member of the Provisional Executive Council, C, a municipal councillor, D, a person in the employ of state whose participation in bidding for the contract may result in a conflict of interest. D is a bit different, to A, B, and C, in that it leaves the judgment call to be made by the accounting officer. But the others are quite difficult. E, an entity in which a person mentioned in paragraph A to D is a director or has a controlling or other substantial interest. And unfortunately, in the real world, because we are legislating for the real world here, it's mostly companies that bid for these things. It's companies that bid. And how do I know that one individual or the other mentioned above has with a substantial interest in that company? It may be that it's with 2%. And that 2% may as well be, when you look at it as a percentage, small percentage, but it may well be equal to 2 billion rand. How do you determine that? The bill defines a person in the employ of the state as follows: a member of the board of directors of any municipality entity, an official of any municipality or municipal entity, an employee of any national or provincial government, department, national or provincial public entity, or constitutional institution with the meaning of the Public Finance Management Act. D, a member of the accounting authority of any national or provincial public entity. And E, an employee of Parliament or provincial legislature. I must hasten to indicate that we agree that these people must not be doing business with Parliament. We agree. No qualms. But all we're saying is that the way it is phrased now, the way it stands, is going to be very difficult to monitor and administer. We are in no way seeking that these people must do business, but they must not. It is an offense to contravene these provisions, and a person convicted is liable to a fine or imprisonment. Subclauses 46D and E, read the definition of person in the employ of state, provide implementation challenges as these lack sufficient clarity. It is neither clear what is meant by may result in a conflict of interest, nor what a controlling or other substantial interest means. Regulating the supply chain management policy is based on the constitutional obligation in section 217, which provides that when an organ of state contracts for goods or services, it must do so in accordance with a system which is fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective. The PFMA provides in a similar fashion, section 38, be that as it may, the prohibition on contracts appear to follow the regulations to the local government's Municipal Finance Management Act 56 of 2003. This prohibition is also visited by criminal sanction. However, the latter provisions are clear and do not refer to the situation where the participation in bidding for the contract may result in a conflict of interest or a controlling or other substantial interest. My emphasis is subclause 46D and E of the bill. So the uncertainty created by subclauses 46D and E is irreconcilable with the criminal consequences of contravening these provisions. The difficulty in addressing this is evident in the omission of a definition in the bill for the phrases emphasized above. In light of the fact that the clauses 40 captures the consumer obligation in section 217 mentioned above, I suggest that subclauses 46D and B and E be omitted from the bill. I suggest that clauses 46D and E be omitted from the bill because of the difficulty it would pose in respect of implementation. Just to give you an example, sir, somebody once said that managing in Parliament is managing on moving sands, shifting sands. This is a political institution. It may be we do our planning very well, sir. But political imperatives make it possible for us to have a huge function just next week. Today is Tuesday. That something must happen over the weekend. This committee must go out to KwaZulu-Natal. This committee must go to the Eastern Cape. And to go to the Eastern Cape, you want to cater, you want to have transport, and these things must happen now because Parliament must function. Now it means, therefore, that all the people who submit their bids must go through a thorough process of knowing who is the owner, whether this owner is employed by the state, whether this owner is a member of the municipal council, he's got a substantial interest or not. And if I were to contract one of these people and somebody gets to know that we did this thing, this person reports to Parliament, it means in terms of the bill I must go to prison because I've done it against the law. So that's the difficulty that we're trying to point out around these matters. Just one of the small things that I don't think would create a big problem. When we talk about the preparation of the bill, the duties of the accounting officer, I think just for consistency's sake, at one stage we speak about the parliamentary administration of Parliament, and some will speak about Parliament. I prefer that we speak about Parliament because that which we do is done for the rest of Parliament. Instead of in areas, you say, budget or strategic plan for the administration of Parliament, because strategic plan is for the rest of Parliament. Just for purposes of consistency. And I'll raise my case there, sir, and take some questions. Thank you very much.
Okay. That's it. Because the secretary now is consulting the drafter, and the drafter is also from Parliament and from his office, I suspect. And this is why I was saying earlier, Mr. Jenkins was like on his own, doing all the things he did. Now his boss is questioning those things. It's something that we've got to resolve finally. He is raising a whole range of things, members, questions, comments on the issues that the secretary raises. The supply chain issues are also raised, and he's raising them strongly. He says, how should I know if in this area, I mean, look, this is an ordinary economic activity. So many people are involved in these things. Some are shareholders, etc., etc., etc. Somebody would then come and bid. And when it's normally CEOs and everybody else, shareholders and all other people are not there. And amongst the shareholders is this councillor, is this member of parliament, etc., etc. How does he have to deal with those things? There you go. Question? questions, comments, and clarities, just broadly on the submission? Yes, 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 Mr. Robertson and Mr. Potter.
Jay, I just need some clarity to see if I've got it right in my mind. On page 4 of the presentation, under space for innovative and creative management, Jay, my understanding is that the Public Finance Management Act was designed for all government departments and all that. But in here it says, most of which appears to be borrowed from the Public Finance Management Act. Now, the other that hasn't been borrowed from the PSM, where does that come from and how will that fit into the Public Management Finance Act? Thank you.
I'm not so sure, perhaps we have more clarity in regarding of what was actually the presentation. You said that the chairperson, well, the oversight, strategic plan, the deputy speaker, the parliament, permanent deputies, chairperson, that is an oversight committee of parliament of different parties. But how will that relationship working then in regarding of the joint committee who's be setting up, neither the executive, namely the speaker, the deputy speaker, the deputy chairperson, is not a part of that, because there must be a relationship. So, as I understand that, well, there's two committees now. The one of this political oversight, and then a joint committee. Now, I mean, there must be a relation or a working between the two. The one is higher than the other. The joint committee is a committee who will oversight and looking, and they have to report to somewhere. But also here is another committee who have to report somewhere. Now, that is not clear for me how the two will join somewhere. Will there not be a big clash? Because the joint committee will be past members of parliament. Normal members. Perhaps a chairperson of NPA from the NA and from the NCOP. There's a joint committee. But now here you're sitting with the permanent deputy chairperson, the chief whip, and all that. And I see a clash here. Really, I see a clash here where the two authorities, the one is politically higher than the other one, but the other one is administratively better office than the other one. And that is not clear for me. So I'm questioning that, Chair.
I think I've said we must take this discussion a bit seriously. So I don't want to leave gaps. Everything must be attended to. We'll take the first two questions and then we'll come to you, President.
Thanks, Chair. The point that we're making, I hope I got the question very well from the member. The point that we're making about putting in a law, normal management actions, we're saying that's superfluous. You don't need that. You don't need that in the law, because those are the normal expected actions of a manager. Manager must do that. Manager must make sure that his management group get proper training, that the people who get appointed in financial management areas are given proper training, etc., etc. That's what we're saying. So it does not need to be in the law. But having said that, say we you know, the principles and values in respect of financial management that are enshrined in the PFMA, I believe those values and principles belong to the state as a whole, to the Republic of South Africa. They are not catered for a certain portion of the Republic and not for other portions. And therefore, those values, as they stand in the PFMA, if they are good for the government departments and other institutions of the state, that is good also for parliament. That's the point that we're making. But I was saying that training, really, you don't have to put training in a law. You don't have to do that. Over answering the question. I think the second question in respect of the POA, that's the point that I'm trying to make.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I know that you have ruled that maybe these two questions perhaps be dealt with, but I also wanted to expand on the questions that Honorable Porter has raised. Maybe I wanted to do it before, because so that we don't repeat the same thing. Thank you, Chair. You see, my understanding of the question that Comrade Porter is raising is that Chair is, I think that maybe is also the crux of the what you call of this deal of the role of this joint committee and the role of the POA. And by the way, on the lighter side, Secretary, I'm a chairperson of the joint budget. I'm a co-chairperson of the joint budget. I might be without a job with the establishment of this committee. So I'm on your side. I'll defend. But on a more serious side, we have my understanding of this bill, my reading of this bill. I just want us a clear interpretation so that for my own understanding and ensure that I don't read what I want to hear. Luckily, the lawyers are here. I know that the secretary has read it. It says a joint committee of parliament must maintain oversight of the financial management of by among other things, considering the draft and blah blah blah. So it doesn't say that this joint committee will compile your draft strategic plans, your budget, and all those things. From my own understanding, is that the assumption from this clause is that someone else will do these things, and they will be brought to this committee, and that authority is with the POA. Whoever does, I'm just generalizing when I'm saying with the POA. And the comparison that the secretary, for instance, is making is with respect to the audit law or audit act, where the audit act speaks about coming up with a committee that will do oversight, an oversight mechanism. But this bill does not choose to say that. It says a joint committee. And even in that what they call a bill, the understanding, so I think that my understanding was that there was a lot of what you call it discussion in that what you call the act as well, to say how is this mechanism going to be what you call it done. And because the Constitution does not provide for the National Council of Provinces having oversight over the Auditor General, but only the National Assembly, therefore that committee would be constituted as a national what you call the assembly. But with this one, for Parliament, which the understanding here, I think, is comes from the fact that Parliament consists of two houses, and therefore there will be a joint committee to do oversight over the work that the POA is doing. Because POA here, I assume that assumption is like a minister or something, is an executive authority. And the executive authority here rests with the POA. And it means, I think what this bill says is somebody must do oversight over them. Now, if the what you call it, we have a problem with that, mistake is made, that committee is a parliament. I think that I'm part of people who make those mistakes. Because parliament as a whole, it means that all of us here and all other people, if we were to sit in one committee, all of us, and do one thing, clearly we would not be able to do work. Therefore, parliament establishes committees to do work on its behalf. So here it means that this committee is established on behalf of parliament to do this work on behalf of parliament. So it cannot be what you call there would be difficulty if the parliamentary oversight authority draws up the budget and then also does oversight over themselves. They should be players and referees. I think that is the suggestion that we're coming up with. Is that what we want to say? I think my understanding of that question, Chair. And so I would really like the question that I would like the Secretary to address himself to. Thank you.
I felt last time when we discussed this, both in passing and serious, I did raise the question, who monitors the monitor? That's just fundamentally the issue. Who monitors the monitor? Parliament does oversight over everybody in the country. And therefore, who does oversight over Parliament, fundamentally? Because also, Parliament is a spending agency, if you like. It's given money, it spends efficiently, effectively, economically. But then, who does oversight over all of those matters? I think that's what you say. And so clearly, these are issues, because the Secretary says, a committee is but an extension. And so clearly, it's a subsection of the whole. And so who does then oversight over the whole? Secretary.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think what we're moving here, Chairperson, is that, like I said in the beginning, if you look at Chapter 3 of the bill, preparation of strategic plan, annual performance plan and budget, that's on page 9 of the bill, clearly puts the responsibility for doing that in the hands of the executive authority. That's correct, the executive authority. But we are saying that the bill further confuses the issues when it comes to giving responsibilities to this joint committee, because it further goes on to give the responsibilities of the executive authority to that joint committee. Whereas our understanding is that the joint committee, whether you call it a joint committee or what, it must be exercising oversight. We agree with you. But it cannot exercise oversight over how the budget is spent, and at the same time determine how that budget must be like. All we're saying is that you leave the responsibility for overseeing the preparation of the budget, the strategic plan, the operational plan, all those things, in the hands of the executive authority. But that the joint committee or any mechanism that you put in place becomes responsible for oversight and nothing else. That's the point that we're making. Thank you, sir.
In other words, they don't do the budget, etc., 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 and then look at all those other things. But let me just come back to the members. Chief, Mr. Robertson, are you fine? Eh? Okay.
Just a follow-up question, and as we know, the BFMA is like a Bible. Now, if we implement this, would we have to change the PFMA? Thank you.
That's an interesting question in the sense that there's already a PFMA review already. I think we'll have to come back to that one a bit later. Let's take question.
Thanks, Chairperson. And I'm on the clause 46, prohibition of contracts. The secretary there says that we should do away with subsection D and E. The reason given is that this can't be monitored. Then the question that I had in my head is that can't be monitored by who? Because the monitoring function exists at both oversight and management level. Then if we do away, especially with D, if we do away with D, who is going to, how do we cater for an HOD or a senior manager who is involved in this contract? So how do we cater for that?
Thanks, sir. Like I said at the beginning, sir, that we are in no way advocating for any of those categories of people to do business with Parliament. We're saying that we agree they must not do business with Parliament. The difficulty, though, of a bill like this becoming law is in its implementation, its administration. Monitoring as to whether when you do get involved in contracts with anybody, that you do not do so in conflict with the law. That's the point that I'm making. And I think that this matter, because this does not just go alone, it goes with criminal penalties or sanctions. We think that the matter can be better handled in regulations rather than in the law. That's what we think. We may be wrong, but we don't think that as it stands is going to be making it easy, because the point that we're making, say, is that think about any contract. That means my procurement people must move. I must get against underspending every year. That means every contract that we get involved in, we must rush to. If there's a list of 200, which have even 500 bidders, we must immediately go into work and look at all those bidders before we take any decision. Look at those bidders. I'm telling you, we would not a year even spend 20% of our budget. That's the difficulty that is. And by saying so, I'm in no way condoning anybody, whether a manager or anybody who may want to do business with Parliament, because that would be wrong. I'm not condoning that. I'm saying my difficulty is in the implementation of this thing when it becomes law. That's what we're saying.
Essentially what you're saying, Brass 10, of the 10 bidders that we have, somebody must go and look at who are these individuals in each company. If one company has these men and women, are they councillors? Are they members of parliament? Are they, in other words, you come here as Siyazama, but let's also know who these people in Siyazama are. All of the people that are there. That's the issue, and therefore he says it's going to be problematic to implement, because what it means is that before you even adjudicate
go back and start looking for all of these people. Who are these people? What do they do? Etc., etc. Then finally, you adjudicate. But there might also be some disputes, etc., just besides the who, the faces that are in the companies, shareholders, and so on, and so on, and so on. And so he says, as a result of that, he thinks, let's not put it in law as is, because it's going to arrest development, if you like, because the accounting officer cannot move, because he must start doing those things, because mindful of the fact that if he does that, there's a criminal sanction already. It's breaking the law. And so clearly that's the big issue he's raising there. Mr. Sokon.
I think that this one seems to be a bit difficult. However, there are precedences. For instance, if you look at the Municipal Finance Management Act, it does not in detail go to this, but it does indicate that, look, these following people are not supposed to participate, or their relatives or what. There are regulatory regulations which deal also with that. But I think that the fact of the matter here is that now, as Parliament, we're saying we do not want to fall under those, what you call it, and under those acts and those kind of things. And therefore, if we say, for instance, we do hear the secretary's argument that it makes sense that they must be in the regulations. But generally, even if they are in the regulations, but if maybe take just going one step back, is that what is the whole objective of raising this matter in the supply chain management? I think that the whole objective is to say, how do you ensure that you mentioned Siyazama here. I spent the last 5 years, I think of the 5 years that I spent here, 3 years, there was an advert of Siyazama. If it's not now, here, now, all the time, it was Siyazama. Ever since I arrived here, it was Siyazama. I've never seen another, what you call a person working here in Parliament. It was this Siyazama. It would be interesting to really to know who is this Siyazama and those kind of things. So now, I mean, the supply chain management, the intention is to ensure that with these meager resources that people have, there is your distribution of wealth. But I think that what he is trying to prohibit here, whether it's in the regulations sector, whether it's to ensure that we don't, what you call it, it can be easy for us. Secretary is my friend, we go to secretary. I got my son, he has qualified as a furniture maker or what. Can you, what you call it, do something here for furniture? Then I know that my son is going to come in and take that because he has qualified. But I think that the whole objective is to ensure that rather than this work of Parliament being given back to the officials or members of Parliament or relatives or what, at least is given to other people outside who really have no, what you call it, interest. Not that our relatives or what should not be engaged in any economic activity, but how do you do the balance such that they are not, what you call it, we don't create work for ourselves outside. That's fine. But the question of whether that at the end, if there has been a transgression of that clause, then it would result into a misconduct I'm not sure about that, but my understanding of a misconduct. Because, Chairperson, we did raise that this bill, we're calling it Financial Management of Parliament Bill. In reality, we could be calling it the extension of the PFMA. Because almost everything that is here is taken from PFMA, but under a new name now of Parliament. And my understanding then of PFMA is that the question of financial misconduct, which could result, for instance, in the officials being taken to court, is when there's a serious, what they call, I think it was clause 8, I don't know what clause, I don't want to quote the wrong clause, but it talks about a serious misconduct of financial, what they call, matters. And clearly, I think that all of us in this house, we do have experiences. We have seen situations. I'm sure Limpopo would tell you about clearly where officials clearly have intentionally misused public funds for their own, what you call, their objectives. The scopper there in Limpopo is busy with some cases, and I really take my hat off to the scopper of Limpopo. I wish that all the scoppers could work like the scopper of Limpopo does. Now, if then we say no, if the, unfortunately, the accounting, it will be the responsibility, the backstop at the door of the accounting officer. If anybody...
Let me just check something. Do we, I want us to look at the principled view now, in view of especially this aspect, so that we don't deal with the whole detail, if you like, because the detail is going to be a bit problematic. I do want us to throw it back to somebody to deal with. In principle, would we want to agree with what the Secretary says? I think that's the direction, just in respect of this particular discussion now, so that as we deal with it, we say we disagree or we agree. Do we say in principle we agree with what he says? Let's not legislate whilst these issues are critical. Let's then throw all detail into regulation. Of course, as we are saying, the regulation is also going to be a bit complicated. Let's not worry much about that ourselves. Let somebody worry about the detail of the regulation. Of course, the regulation will come before us. So I'm just saying, let's just deal with that kind of a discussion. We think the argument he's raising is right in principle, and so on and so on. Proceed then.
I'm sorry, Chairperson.
I'm coming to you, Machaka.
I'm sorry, Chair. I think this exercise is... I think this is a public hearing. We are allowing the Secretary to put his views and somebody else to put their views. The committee must deliberate on this matter. And I'm not sure if we should be doing... if we should take a view now, when the committee has not yet the chance to really look at it independently of for now. But I think that what we're doing now is to just to get clarity in terms of what he's saying, so that then we can take a decision later. Thank
you. Thank you, Honorable Chair, and my apologies for coming some few minutes later.
Welcome to this brand new committee.
We started in another meeting. I'm just coming in as an alternate member. I might have missed other important, you know, deliberations as the process started. But my understanding is that today is public hearings where certain stakeholders will make input. And the committee, correctly so, as Mr. Sokone has said, I don't think it's under that pressure to finalize everything today, so that we allow other processes to unfold you might need Chairperson maybe also to make some research about this matter, so that you check in other jurisdictions, in other parliaments, which maybe have similar pieces of legislation. How do they deal with that? Because as I hear the Secretary, he has got no principal objection to say we should exclude certain people and so on in this. And his worry is that it must not stifle the process. He quoted some certain exceptional circumstances which might not be normal everyday, you know, prevailing scenario in terms of how they handle transactions in Parliament. But those exceptional situations will not be happening in each and every 365 day of the year and so on. You might also, part of the section of the law, allow for those exceptions to take place. You can also have certain categories, because you can't say Parliament deals with various categories of tenders and so on. In a tender of maybe 15 million, you can't allow that you have an X number of members of Parliament also being part of that company. You might need, even if you issue that tender, you say no company having the following categories of people to be there. But what I'm trying to say, let's note what the Secretary is submitting to the committee as one of the stakeholders. Then we come to a day where we deliberate. We can then finalize after we've also make our own consultations and research so that we pass on this area. Thank you.
Chairperson, I must submit immediately that VV has covered my point, because I don't think we must sit and make a termination now, unless if one did the Secretary to go away with an impression. But I don't think that is necessary. I think he has covered me.
Thanks, Chairperson. Yes, I agree with the members that the members might not.
The legal advisor of the Free State Legislature. Proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's against the suggestion, Chairperson, that the paragraphs E and D must go to the regulations. My view, Chairperson, to that is that it's not going to have to take it to regulations, because even the regulations, they are equally enforceable, like this piece of legislation. If you take it there, you're still going to have to implement it and then enforce it, Chairperson, the same way that you are implementing the main act, Chairperson. Maybe just, Chairperson, just my suggestion is that to have a look at the wording, don't take it to the regulations, Chairperson. It won't help members, because they're still going to come back and haunt you.
You know, I'm worried now. We have allowed him. I think there are many Watukala. I've got researchers from Gauteng and there's many of them. My understanding, I might be wrong, is that one of your observations at the beginning was that we are a unitary state, and therefore this process it's a process that we assume as members of Parliament. It evolved from consultation between Parliament and the legislature. So they've had their, what they call, a bite. Now we're giving them the second bite. I thought that this level here is for members of Parliament. They can, so that when we seek, I think we should make a special request if we need their advice here, then we allow them. But I think that the priority must be for members.
Okay. Hello, sir.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Grant Snell. I'm a member of the legislature from the Eastern Cape. Apologies also for arriving late. Our flight was later than we expected. Chair, my understanding is the public hearing, this meeting, and so therefore members of the public should be allowed to participate. And there are three principles that I'd like to raise, Chair. One, you mentioned earlier the thing of who oversights the oversighter. But in this piece of legislation, I can't see anything that gives the executive authority some kind of leverage to negotiate Parliament's budget with the Treasury. the executive, but the executive determines the resources that you have available to do your oversight. There might need to be something in the legislation that gives the executive authority some kind of influence over that budget. The second one is the secretary to the legislature has to determine your strategic plans and your operational plans, but it doesn't say anything in here about the executive committee coming up with a political vision for the five-year period that would then enable the secretary with his team to put in those plans linked to budgets. And the other issue is that I would want to agree with the secretary that the legislation does spell out the role of the accounting officer with regards to strategic plans, operational plans, budgets, and therefore in your section 4 I wouldn't want to see the clause A forming part of that, because that committee can't oversight a budget that it itself has been part of preparing for the year or strategic plans. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chairperson. If I captured it very well, I believe the Secretary also recommended that Clause 7, E and F should be removed. If that is the case, I want to check what makes it, why is he uncomfortable with that? Because to me, it's necessary for the oversight authority to understand those two, that they are, of course, there are instruments, there are instruments in place with the Parliament. Thank you.
Functions of any manager. You don't need those things in law. I mean, it would appear that we're writing laws in a manner in which does not show that we're a smart parliament. That's all I'm saying. You don't need those things in law.
Secretary says you don't want to in legislation kind of create micromanagement issues, if you like. That's basically the issue. A law must be a broad principled issue, not the micromanaging management issue. And so you must just create a situation where you ensure that. I mean, look, there are systems, there are policies, etc., 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 but you also don't want to create in law small things, really, that would not be very much. I mean, these are things that, as a manager, he or she knows they've got to do. They've got all of those small pieces of legislation, the hymn books, if you like. And so, in the context of the hymn book, they would then be able to deal with those matters. It's a discussion we shall have to engage with broadly, and see how we persuade each other. Look, this is a 76. And the issue is that we are taking this discussion back to provinces on Friday and Thursday, just to brief provinces. So it is a matter that we must really engage brutally in terms of our own negotiating mandates. But as I'm saying, let's also not create many things. You know, one of the things we always say, we do want to have elegant legislation, if you like. You don't want to have all sorts of funny things, as if you're also creating within the same law some subsect, etc., etc. So please, but it's a matter that we shall engage with ourselves, firstly in the committee. We have clarity
in terms of how he sees it himself. Do we see it the same way? We're not responding to that now. We will engage with that in the provinces, in the committee here.
Chair, well, I fully agree with you in the process, but still I'm not clarified about the joint committee. Because, Chair, if you take the authority, executive authority alone, it is high authority. But if you take the joint committee what is in the bill, and I think we must look into that matter, is the joint committee has the power that committees of parliament have under section 56-59 of the constitution. So that joint committee have the power to summon the executive to come and appear in front of them. So, Chair, I mean, there's a little bit of conservation in situation of that, because if the joint committee is extension of the executive to assist him, then it's not. But in regarding what is standing here, they got certain powers in considering the instructions issued by the executive, considering the annual report submitted, they consider the annual budget of the executive. So they can reject everything what is actually in place by the executive. So, and then you say also that issue of the executive authority, the deputy speaker, the National Assembly chairperson must not be a part of the joint committee. That is not a problem. But that executive committee then exists of normal members, then they can summon, they got the powers over that. And I think that will be, that's why I said the relationship, the working relationship then will be clashing. And that is how I see the chair. Perhaps I'm wrong, but if you gave a person the authority to consider or reject, then you have a problem.
No, Mr. Potter, you're right. Look, we will say to the secretary and his team, so just to go back and look at how they phrase this thing properly, from the point of view of the submission they are making. Because you're right, if the committee has powers, it can't just be an extension, therefore, of parliament. It would surely want to exercise its own powers. And so I'm saying, in terms of phrasing the submission they want to make in respect of this thing, they might want to say, as they were quoting the Public Audit Act and oversight mechanism, etc., etc. But also, let's refine this issue that you are raising, but also the relationship, you are correct, so that you don't want to create again the same contradiction. On the one hand, the committee becomes just something that is an extension, whereas in terms of the law it has particular powers, and yet they don't want to see it that way. I'm saying it's a matter that he might respond to now, but if he thinks not much work has been done in ensuring that the oversight mechanism becomes this powerful creature that they are talking about, it's something that they must also look at. Baba.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think, Chairperson, that the point that you cannot have the presiding officers determining what must be in the budget, setting the policy directives that must be included in the strategic plan, but at the same time play oversight overall, has long been accepted within by themselves. That you need a mechanism to do that. I know that discussion emanates from the interactions that we have had in the respect of SCOPA. If I may remind the committee what our argument was in respect of SCOPA. When we were expected to go and account to SCOPA, we said, it's not a question of not wanting to the individuals in SCOPA, but it's a matter of principle. SCOPA is a committee of one house, established in terms of the rules of the National Assembly. And I was saying that I am not secretary of the National Assembly. I'm secretary to Parliament. You need a different mechanism other than SCOPA, where the secretary to Parliament will account.
mechanism would comprise members of both houses. SCOBA may be very good in what it's doing now, but it is not the right mechanism through which to account to Parliament, because it is a committee of one house. And unfortunately, this point was misinterpreted, both in the media and I think to some extent in Parliament, to say that, no, we don't want to account. It was never that matter. And so what we're saying here is that this committee, you need to have a committee where Parliament accounts, or that exercises accountability on behalf of Parliament. But that committee cannot do all the things. It cannot be responsible to have oversight over the preparation of the budget, and at the same time, exercise oversight over the expenses it can. It must do one thing. There must also be an acceptance of the fact that we've got executive authority in the persons of the Speaker and the Chairperson of the NCOP, who have direct powers. These people are elected in terms of the constitution of the country. They are the people who exercise these original powers from both houses of Parliament. And you cannot dilute that in this law. It would be wrong to do that. We must accept that the presiding officers would continue to be members of the POA, giving direction to the institution, giving policy directives. But you need some mechanism that would therefore come back and play oversight over the expenditures of the system. You need that oversight. That is why we will say that don't even call it a joint committee. That's why we are saying no submission. Do not go to details to who must be members of that oversight mechanism. Leave it as a mechanism. In that way, from time to time, Parliament, don't limit Parliament's constitutional powers. Because it may be that at one stage you put this thing, it does not work, that means you must go and amend the law. Make it easier for you to govern the institution. If you allow me, so the last point I want to make is in respect of this consistency that I talked about, accepting some of the good practices that we have seen in place here in Parliament. For instance, in this same bill, we are talking about, let me refer you to the what this bill, the object of the bill, one of the key issues of the bill, the long title of the bill, to regulate the financial management of Parliament in a manner consistent with its status in terms of the Constitution. And Parliament has responded to that and put a policy together only last year. I am sure that members of Parliament will be aware of that. So-called 14-page document. Which 14-page document actually makes it clear that Parliament cannot be treated like a government department, where Parliament must go and form a queue with the government department in respect of getting resources. And I'm saying, and it has gone far to say that it is not okay for Parliament, therefore. Not that you don't want to recognize the fact that it's a national treasury. There is a national treasury that prepares all these things, but it can be correct for Parliament to sit, when it wants to appropriate funds, to sit with a direct report of a substructure of government, or substructure of a branch of government to do that. But the correct thing for Parliament to do is to sit down, because the presiding officers are ahead of a branch of government. For them to go and sit with a direct report of a substructure of government is not consistent with the constitutional status of Parliament. It's wrong. And that document says, therefore, that the presiding officers must actually be sitting in a meeting with the Treasury Committee chaired by the President of the country, who is head of another branch of government. I'm saying that it doesn't appear that in this bill that point has been taken into account. Because that policy document, as I understand, has been adopted in the institution. So I'm talking about this inconsistency. I'm trying to help the committee.
There are just a few things that I need to clear in my head. If Parliament receives taxpayers' money, if Parliament receives money from the taxpayers, then it is a sphere of oversight for using taxpayers' money. I'm not saying all the money comes from taxpayers. So it is a part of the oversight of Treasury and all that. Chair, as we all know, this bill has been taken years now to try and implement. And I hear what the Secretary is saying, that SCOPA doesn't represent Parliament. And the Secretary also says that maybe he doesn't want a joint committee. But if we look at finance, Chair, we've got the Portfolio Committee and the Select Committee. And then we've got the joint committee led by my tall comrade across the road, who is the co-chair. Now, what one would like to suggest is that there are two suggestions, Chair. The first one would be that members from the NCOP serve on SCOPA, which makes it a parliamentary committee. And the second one is you have a joint SCOPA between the NCOP and the NA. Thank you, Chair.
We will come back to that other discussion now, but I think let's just wind up the discussion of the Secretary's input. We still have two to deal with. Yes, ma'am.
Now, Chair, you really, you know, the Secretary raised a matter that I was interested in, but I didn't want to raise it because I thought that it was not a subject for discussion. But now, that's why I'm saying you will rule. He has put it on the table. This issue of, in his comment, last comment, this issue of Parliament, not what you call him wanting to chew with departments because it's not a part of the executive. And I think that there's no what you call a discussion about that. We all agree. Parliament is Parliament. Executive is executive. But a government has got three what you call branches. Parliament, the executive, the judiciary. Now, if we pass this law tomorrow, it means that the next day we must now prepare another what you call a piece of legislation for judiciary. Is that what you call it, we say? That's why I'm saying. So I thought that this was not necessarily a part of this discussion. We would avoid that. But the Secretary...
We won't avoid it. We will engage with that discussion, but not now.
That's an issue that really...
So no, we will come back to it, don't worry, not now. But also what he's raising is the policy which he thinks is not catered for in the bill, which is something that we might also want to have some sight over and just see how it is catered for in the bill. But then, let's then, for now, I hope everybody has understood what the submission of the Secretary says. But before Mr. Jenkins, Mam Tunu.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I was going to add my voice also to 46 DNE and say that if we omit this, we'll not be protecting the people who are working for the state, because right now one would hear that they are always claiming.
Well, that would be for the discussion in the committee. Don't worry.
Okay, so I leave it.
We will deal with that at that stage. Mr. Jenkins.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Now, Honourable Chair, I wear this...
Wearing the cap of the drafter, of the legal advisor, of the secretary.
No, I wear all those caps, Honourable Chair. I just do my job here, and I'm quite flexible when things come around. Honourable Chair, just on a point of clarity, and for the benefit of the committee, the issue around Clause 7, I just want to point out that when we're talking about 7E and F, the appropriate systems to manage the performance and that there are suitable training and awareness programs, one needs to read that together with Clause 69.
which says, if I can quote, it's an offence for the accounting officer to deliberately or in a grossly negligent way contravene or fail or comply with the provision of Section 7. And then it carries on to set up the offence there. So the point that there is, it seems, but it's good to regulate like that. But when one connects it to a criminal offence, one must ask yourself, do we really want to make this a crime?
No, we will talk with you in our discussion. You don't worry, you are forever in our discussion yourself. So we'll engage with that. It either goes or it stays. 7 either goes or stays. But you will be part of that discussion. Don't worry much about that. Okay, can we then take the FFC's submission? Deputy Chair, FFC.
Thank you, Chairperson. You know, when I received your letter, or when the chairperson of the commission asked me to come here, he didn't tell me that he wanted me to come and make a presentation. I thought I did make a presentation in December to this committee on this matter. But maybe what I need to
what do you can do now, just briefly, what are the highlights of that?
Yeah.
Just for the benefit of those who are not there.
Yeah, okay, that's what I actually planned to do, is to just give you the key issues that basically the commission is concerned about. The one is really a matter that is not for the commission to decide, but it's the general principle around the bill, basically. We from the commission's perspective, we are not convinced that you can actually justify putting up a separate bill to a separate legislation to managing Parliament's finances, which is outside of your general Public Finance Management Act. And the simple reason basically around that is that we do basically recognize the issue around the separation of powers, but we also think that there are a lot of other complicating matters which actually arise, which this particular bill does not take into consideration. There are institutions that are outside of the executive. They're also the standalone state institutions, like your Chapter 9 institutions, which fall either way, in one way or another. An example that we use in our submission is the Financial and Fiscal Commission. We have a very complicated situation where the Commission must report to Parliament. It's in Chapter 13. And our finances basically sit with the National Treasury in one way or another as a little piece of thing in the Treasury's. We are expected to be an independent kind of an institution with its own powers. We've got a chairperson who happens to be the CEO, who also happens to be a member of the Commission. At the moment, we are not even sure who is the executive authority of the Commission. The Qatar Asmal process made certain proposals around that. It's a very complicated kind of an issue, and if let's say that it is basically decided by this committee that no, we're going to go along with this process and establish an act of parliament that will deal with that, we basically believe that you need to also take those other issues that are outside of this into consideration. Obviously, you will have to come back again to the issue that the Honourable Chairperson next to me here is raising around the third arm of government. You will have to deal with the issues, same issues around the judiciary. I don't think that's something that one can run away from. So that's an in principle kind of an observation that the Commission is raising. And we basically believe that the current review of the PFMA, which is in progress right now, should have been taken advantage of to address some of these key issues that are related to this. we think need to be addressed in the bill as it currently stands. Basically, my specific recommendation starts off by saying that if a sufficient case for this bill can be made, the Commission then makes the following recommendations on specific sections. The first one relates to Clause 5, strengthen the relationship between executive authority and the Joint Committee of Parliament. The executive authority must report quarterly on the financial performance of Parliament. The bill provides that appropriated money unspent, that's Clause 23, unspent by Parliament should not be taken away from it. The Commission is of the view that for consistency, the same principles that Parliament demands of other state institutions must also subject itself to those. Now, I think one can talk about where money that is spent or appropriated and spent by Parliament comes from. It comes from the same pocket. It comes from the same pool, primarily, where everybody else dips from. And we believe that there's an opportunity cost to resources as you allocate them. Now, when you don't spend money, somebody else somewhere is basically compromised. Now, if you don't spend money continuously and you continuously have to keep your money and there's no sanction from where the money is coming from, or from the pool, there must be certain costs to that society in general must actually pay, and we believe that this should basically be rethought in that sense. There are issues to deal with asset management and procurement policies which we think need to be developed that relates to Clause 30. And then there's an issue dealing with transfers, which we think is a little bit vague under definitions and interpretations. There's a need to clarify what is meant by payment and a transfer. The key issue here is that a transfer is not necessarily expenditure, so there's something to be clarified there. And also, there's a clarity in terms of Clause 36 needed on the role of National Treasury in this regard, and as the Treasury can only report on quarterly performance in terms of Section 32 of the PFMA, which is not applicable in this particular bill. So those are the key issues that we thought we needed to raise outside of what we think the potential for other independent kind of institutions might actually. I don't know whether municipalities and councils within the local government sphere are the same kind of a thing. In which case, one would suspect that councils must also have their own piece like this. They are legislatures, aren't they?
Okay, thank you very much. The deputy chairperson of the FFC says the separation of powers rationale is weak. And he says the IEC, Independent Electoral Commission, the Financial and Fiscal Commission, the Judiciary, and many others can also come up and say, well, we are independent, and therefore in the context of the separation of powers argument, give us a piece of legislation too. That's what they are saying. He says, in fact, their budgets are sitting in some pockets, sub-programs in some departments. IEC is Home Affairs. Their budget is National Treasury. But then he also raises a matter which we did not talk about, which has to do with something called unspent funds that must be kept by Parliament. Of course, there is an agreement which motivation I don't even understand now. But there is an agreement between National Treasury and Parliament to keep unspent money. Now, for us, unspent money is equal to underspending, if you like. And so what we're doing is to legislate that Parliament must underspend. And so the issue is, what moral grounds would you have as Parliament to call other entities not to underspend when you yourselves legislate that you must underspend? That's the issue. What would create underspending or unspent funds? That would mean that plans are not aligned. There are no clear plans. There's no alignment and so on and so on. There would be budget games, if you like, overstated budget, and so there is unspent funds. But therefore the principal issue is this money must be sent back to the National Revenue Fund. And so the FFC, for instance, by law, is not allowed to overspend its own FFC Act. But now we're going to create a precedent that says no, Parliament must underspend, by the way. That's the bottom line. Is that what we want to do? So these are issues that the FFC raises in terms of this matter. But then they also broadly say, essentially what we're talking about here is, we're talking public finances, by the way, because all of this money is revenue raised from taxpayers' money. And so the Public Finance Management Act is not some sketch that cannot be used as a piece of legislation to hold Parliament accountable on, precisely because these are public funds that we're talking about essentially. And so we shouldn't be semantic about it. I suspect that's what the FFC is saying. And so the principles and everything which the Secretary alluded to that are in the Public Finance Management, in fact, essentially, I suspect, in the context of the review that they are talking about, why is it that we don't create an environment in the PFMA that also talks to issues of accountability, especially financial management issues of Parliament, so that therefore you don't have 20 pieces of legislation. Because we've got to have this piece of legislation for the National Parliament, and then we've got to have 9 bits of legislation again for different provinces, and I'm not sure how many other entities we might have. The IEC, the FFC, the Judiciary, and so on and so on. The Commission of the Languages Commission, and so on and so on. So I'm saying that's basically about that. And maybe therefore it comes back to my earlier discussion of federalism, because each province, like in America, would have its own piece of this and that legislation. Comments, questions, and clarities on the FFC document now. Madam Kunu, Vivi.
But in a federal state, they will state that finances are raised by the states or provinces and they don't go to the national fiscus, so they have all the right to decide on what they can do with the provincial or state finances. In this case, all the finances go to the national fiscus, and so the people who are poor on the ground, they have a say, and they are the ones who do the oversight on us. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I'm not sure how one does interact with the submission, because the honorable gentleman said they were not well communicated to. I'm not sure whether they still want to have another opportunity to make another submission, but if you are done now, I don't think we will pressurize you to go and invent other in the submissions you don't want to submit. But one, I think, the other point which was raised is a constitutional framework that we've got these three different organs in terms of separation of power. And then you can't then take the three and start equating them, some of them, with the FFC and the IEC and so on. Although the principle of impartiality still, applies to them, which is also certain, measures of ensuring that we've got a fair system in terms of our democracy in the country as such. But you can't then equate them with the three organs of state as stipulated by the constitution. Of course, you will then have some of them attached to certain departments, which for now, it's what prevails in the country. I know there was that ad hoc committee which came with certain recommendations, but I don't recall those being adopted anywhere as a policy framework for the country. So they were just noted, as far as I know. So the status quo still prevails. I think everyone still relates to whatever department. If it's IEC with Department of Home Affairs, they will still relate like that, and so on and so on. The other one is that in terms of because you will have one national treasurer, but the point is that you should not then stifle the other organs of state by saying they can't have what they deserve in terms of financial allocation. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Eastern Cape legislature already have a system which has not been problematic, where the legislature get its cut, then the other departments we will still get. Of course, we will not be ultra ambitious to say we'll then cut on what the hospitals will have and so on. Maybe we might decide to cut on one warplane or what have you and so on, to ensure that also, as much as we want our democracy to mushroom, because if you don't have an oversight which is well capacitated, you can then ensure that the constitutional framework of holding the executive is well attended to. I remember, Chairperson, in one piece of legislation we're dealing with, one legislature complained that they no longer have funds for public hearings and so on, that kind of a thing and so on. So it then helps your democratic system to be fully, fleshed. But of course, you must have certain, checks and balances to deal with that system. The issue of the judiciary also wanting to take the same route should not then threaten us not to thoroughly look into that issue. Because if the constitution will say they also deserve the same treatment, let it be so. It's a constitution which you adopted, and we said it's a blueprint, it's a constitution which is well recognized throughout the world. And if we have to implement some of those things, let's do them while we can. Because if we don't do them, it then affects in terms of how do you ensure, because the parliament which we are speaking about now is not the parliament which we inherited 15 years back. Like now we're complaining about issue of space and so on. Because I will then understand why maybe the proposal of saying the unspent funds must be kept within the legislature. Because you have a system now, once those funds are not spent, they go back to treasury, they don't come back the following year. Because of how the cake is cut, you don't have that system. Of course, there must be motivation for unspent funds, why they must still come back to that vesting department. Because as the chairperson was saying, if you have not spent, it means there has been non-service delivered in a certain item which was budgeted for and so on. So I think those are issues which we'll have to look into and have a way, balanced way of how we deal with them and so on. and don't allow ourselves maybe to be threatened by worst case scenarios. Of course, you will have to learn from other jurisdictions how they dealt with some of these issues and so on. But on the other hand, it should not also stifle our democracy being strengthened and so on as a country. Thanks.
I like Comrade Vinny's last comment, that maybe we really need to, what you call it, to ensure that we understand what we are doing. Otherwise, by studying what we're doing elsewhere, what are the experiences elsewhere where already this kind of legislation exists. Maybe it's true that, you know, sometimes changes, there's that fear when there's supposed to be changes, something fear of the unknown. It could be. But I think that what we, the same constitution that we're talking about, the earlier the secretary was talking about contradictions. There could be contradictions even in the same constitution that we're talking about. If this constitution that we're talking about, it says it's only national treasure that has this responsibility, and it spells out what will be the role of the national treasure, then now we come back and say, okay, if we're saying so, want to review those roles, maybe we should do that. But I suppose that when the constitution was drawn, I suppose that those wise men and women were clear that yes, I think those, yeah, I thought they were clear that the responsibility of funds, perhaps once we begin to fragment it, it's all over the show. It can pose other, what you call it, challenges. But I think that coming back to the submission of the FFC, they are, is it the first bullet or second bullet which talks about the quarterly report? I think this committee also has a responsibility to pass the division of revenue. And normally, in that division of revenue, what is normally recommended, it's not only the quarterly report. There must also be monthly reports. Whether those monthly reports come to Parliament or not, then it's something else. But I think that we must not just overlook this question of monthly reports, because if sometimes we focus on other reports and not monthly reports, we might end up just neglecting them. But I think that the main, what you call it, principle that is raised by the FFC is whether each and every branch or arm or kind of, a branch of government should have its own, what you call it, type of legislation. The current PFMA, I think that it does make, what you call, a space within the PFMA that says, that make it possible for Parliament, if Parliament wants this kind of legislation, to say, let us fit in within the, what you call, Public Finance Management Act, but specific, what you call, a section that will deal with that will deal with specifically for with Parliament and it goes back to what I said earlier, whether these changes will really assist us in terms of this constitutional obligation of the of National Treasury, which at this stage is the only one that has this responsibility. Because it's clear that whether we make your judiciary have its own, what you call it, piece of legislation, and we have our own piece of legislation, but the Constitution makes the responsibility of mobilizing these funds. They reside with the National Treasury, not with everybody. So, which means that if they do that, then the same National Treasury must still have the responsibility of ensuring that those what you call the resources are you use your economic, your efficiency, or whatever it is that you use in terms of ensuring that they are used. But I really wouldn't want to go to the other details of whether if there has been an underspending or not, what do we do with the underspending. But even if you were to comment on that, again, on the division of revenue, again, Parliament normally makes guidelines in terms of how should they be done. Would we want, for instance, as Parliament, not to be subjected to other provisions that guide whether it's the department in terms of saying, so if you're not using those funds, then there might be a need of those funds elsewhere, rather than sitting with the funds and then come and accumulating. Because clearly, the function of government, I don't think that is really to get rich and accumulate funds, but to make use of those resources. The resources are allocated for specific purposes, not to be kept. So, but I'm saying that maybe it's something that we would have to think about. Chairperson, I think.
Chair, now this funds was not the back going back, was unspent funds. That is really, I don't know what was behind that issue. Because if you have a business plan and you had to spend according to business plan, you can't spend this year. The Act makes provision for rollovers, everything. So there's not necessarily, if you can't build a school this year, you can build it next year or the year afterwards or the year afterwards if you had permission to roll over. But, you know, Chair, just to come back to our oversight in provinces, in municipalities, where money is in bank accounts, big amounts, you know yourself, millions, and there's no, then they plead poverty. Now, I don't have the reason. If money is not spent, I'm not talking about if there's donations from overseas or UN or other case, they will only give money if there's reasons for. They will not just give you money to put in your bank account to have interest. So I would like to know what is the reason behind the issue to say if you're not spending the money this year, according to your business plan, your strategic plan, why did you want to keep that money? Because that is there's a very vague clause that not money not spending not going back. That there's no to say what reasons. That yes, it's not. And I don't know what is the reason behind that. What is the motive behind that in regarding of that process here. And as I say, there is provision for that type of thing.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think that with respect to the FFC is making a serious mistake of wanting to view Parliament, which is the national legislative authority of this country, like substructures of government. It's a serious fundamental mistake. And I mean, it's unthinkable that we can do so. Because Parliament is not the FSC. Parliament cannot be compared to the IEC at all. It's wrong to do that. It means that we're questioning the overall state arrangement in South Africa if we do that. We're beginning to do that. Well, so it's to take it further.
I can misinterpretation of what I say.
To take it further.
I must just clarify something here, Secretary and the Honourable Member. That's why I wanted to come in. The comparison is not between Parliament and the substructures of the state. The comparison was when you deal with Parliament as Parliament, let's look at also the institution that basically are subservient to Parliament, which are supposed to be independent institutions, so that those institutions, if we accept that this bill, we need to get it complete, so that those institutions that are also having similar kinds of problems, we're not comparing them, we're not saying that those institutions must be treated the same, but they must be treated as a whole in this particular, when you're doing this particular bill, again reviewing the PFMA, then those institutions can't be left in a lurch. That's the point that we are raising. We are not saying that those institutions must also have their own pieces of legislation as a result of this process. We are saying let's get the process complete so that the review of the PFMA, if this process goes ahead separate from the review of the PFMA, then those institutions must also be dealt with in those two processes, so that we have a clear set of principles for managing Parliament, for managing public finances of the state. It's not to put them at the same footing, no ways.
Thanks.
But just before that, Secretary, look, the point is, we're not doing comparisons. The principled issue is, these are also independent structures in their own right, which might also come and say, but we need this precisely because we're independent, not because they're comparing themselves. It's a matter that we must also not run away from. Let's confront that. Proceed back.
Thanks, Chair. I would not call for Hansard to record. But I think that we heard very clearly what was said at that time. I'm not going to argue about it. But also the point that we must make, I think, is that we can't compare Parliament to any other substructure. If you want to compare Parliament, you'd want to compare Parliament to the other two branches of government. That is the executive branch of government and the judiciary branch of government. And to that extent, you know, the judiciary, you have a Minister of Justice in South Africa, perhaps in the rest of the world, who has responsibilities aligned to judiciary. You don't have a Minister of Parliament, deliberately so, because Parliament is that embodiment of the aspirations of the people of a country, so we have a Parliament. And it is not only the fact that this must not be compared, but it would be wrong for any law that is administered by a member of the executive branch of government to have effect on Parliament. You cannot have a minister directing how Parliament must be run. It's wrong to do that. It is wrong to do that. The other point that I want to raise is in respect of the unspent funds. It was raised by the FFC. If I could just also, I think like one member suggested or recommended that we need to do research around this matter. I am in no way saying that the committee is decided one way or the other. But let's please agree, if the committee would agree to that proposal, do research around this matter. How are parliaments treated in other jurisdictions? If you look at the commission that is responsible for the House of Commons in England, look at that, look at all the other jurisdictions. Look at the provisions of the Powers and Privileges Act of 1963. Look at those. I don't want to bother me, but I don't want to speak at length. Look at all those issues and all those provisions. And so that as the committee takes its decisions, it has done that. I know I've got a lot of respect for the committee and confidence that it will do so. You see, sir, the fact that Parliament, that's why we've got that policy, and I thought that policy was driven at a political level, the 14-page document, we must give that document to yourselves. One of the fundamental objectives of that policy is to make sure that Parliament's status is recognized. And that status is given to it by the constitution of the country. And I know that many of us make the mistake at the time, even in the public, even in government, in South Africa, of wanting to always, when you think about government, and when you think about government, when you think about parliament, people tend to want to think about parliament in terms and the eyes of the government, executive branch of government. People do not see parliament as an independent branch of government that is the voice of the people of the country. It's a fundamental mistake. I'm not actually of anybody here in this meeting. I'm saying generally in the country it's like that. It might be because perhaps parliament hasn't moved further enough to establish its own profile in the country in respect of its responsibilities and its mandate. I'm saying it might be. That is why people, every time that they think about parliament, they would want to think parliament in terms of a government department, which is not. It is not a government department. Thanks, that's the point I wanted to make. Thank you very much.
Look, there still is this. You have not resolved this one, Secretary. Let me not talk about the IEC and everybody. Let me talk about judiciary. You know, your response that there is a Minister of Justice is not responding to this matter and the independence, therefore, of the judiciary, essentially. And for us, it is a matter that needs to be resolved as an independent now arm of government. Not in the context that there is a Minister of Justice, and therefore, I'm saying because we must be a bit consistent and elegant about these things, but not just dismiss them as if there is a minister and so their budget must be in a pocket there. We must also be forward-looking ourselves as we sit here. You don't want to have a situation where tomorrow the judiciary says, well, we're independent. And so on and so on and so on. Just saying, for me, it is a matter that still would need further elaboration and maybe part of the same research that people are talking about. Okay, ma'am.
Sir, just in one sentence, I think that if it needs be, that the independence of the judiciary must be treated like the same way as parliament, it must be done so. You'd appreciate the fact that I here represent parliament. And I'll speak on behalf of Parliament. But if it needs be that independence of judiciary must be also elevated in terms of the constitution, it must be done, sir. Thank you.
Your last words, Deputy Chair FFC.
Let me respond to the Honourable member that side. Again, let me just repeat that I might have been misinterpreted to compare or put at the same level Parliament and
constitutional bodies, which I consider to be institutions that are more closely related to Parliament than they are to the executive. If that I consider them to be so, and my point was really meant to say, if you go ahead with the process, then you need to consider where those actually fit in that whole process. Now, in terms of, I think you make an example of a legislature that ran out of money because of whatever the executive control of the PES. I am not sure whether this kind of legislation can probably be used to solve that kind of a process. It's basically the way in which money gets allocated, and this legislation is about managing money that will have been appropriated. And I'm not sure what the point basically was there. Now, with respect to the issue around the judiciary, again, I think you have covered my point there. From the FFC side, I think my initial comment was that it's an issue that we don't think that it's for the FFC to take a decision on that. We're just raising the kinds of problems that one will have to deal with, or the realities that will have to be then dealt with if the process basically is to go ahead. I think a general comment that I would like to make is that from our perspective, what basically drove the thinking around this was a reading of Chapter 13 around of the Constitution around treasury control, basically, which makes reference to legislation for spheres of government rather than for organs or whatever one looks, however one looks at it. Now, a sphere of government from our perspective basically covers both the legislature, would address both the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary in whatever way. So that's what basically informed the point of departure for the commission submission. So it's not, and as I said, it's not about the legal kind of basis. It's about entrenching principles of public finance management. So one would like to have a balance around that in terms of how we proceed around these things. I think that's the driver.
Okay, the last input then, because the Auditor General's office is not yet here. I don't see them. The Accountant General. But before that, I see Van Privy.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I see the Deputy Chair of the FFC is also struggling. Maybe to call my surname, it's Van Paul. Maybe the point is that you are busy with this VV, people don't understand. But as a politician, I will say it means vote for victory, so it doesn't offend me. You know, on a lighter note, I was saying to my colleague here from Mpumalanga that the misinterpretation the deputy chair of FFC is speaking about is that we couldn't understand him very well. Maybe wanted that Parliament also adopts them so that they become part of this broader management. But that's on a lighter note. The point one was raising is the one which the Secretary was speaking about. Because currently we have a situation where Parliament is just treated like any other department, is the point the Secretary was raising. Parliament will submit its budget proposals. We want to achieve this and so on. In terms of the new dispensation, you know, and what democracy demands of us to do, then you'll get a response from Treasury to say, cut on committees, cut on that one, and so on and the like. That's the issue I was saying should not happen. Of course, we don't want a totally kind of, you know, independent, because Treasury, you'll have your revenue generation in any country and so on. That's what same applies like through your mix in local municipalities and so on. Because like you were hinting earlier on, we can't say we want a one-size-fits-all kind of legislation for all the other spheres of government. You have got municipalities in this country who cannot, you know, make any means of revenue and so on. They still depend on treasures and so on. So you cannot, like in terms of your judiciary, already there are other finances which are controlled by your chief justice and so on, which are not necessarily managed by the Department of Justice. So it's one area one was saying, let's also make research so that we don't only close ourselves within the borders of South Africa and pretend as if you don't have other parliaments in the world who maybe have some of these pieces of legislation and so on. Because when you make your research, it will empower you and it will come with certain results where there have been, you know, bad lessons learned, where there have been good lessons learned and so on. And then you can come with a very balanced approach of how you deal with that kind of thing and so on. So I think that's a point we should also not miss. Because currently, as it is, in most of the provincial legislatures, you get the provincial treasuries dictate to the legislatures how much should you get. And that disempowers those legislatures to do effective oversight on the provincial departments. And we're saying that is not good for our democracy. Let's cross that barrier and so on. I think that's the thrust of the matter we're raising.
Thank you, Chair. Further to that input, Chair, I think it's Parliament's responsibility and the legislature's responsibility to resource democracy in this country, to achieve participatory democracy. And if Parliament doesn't find ways to be able to resource democracy, how do those that are marginalised due to their financial position compete on an equal footing? It's impossible. No one's saying that the role of Treasury, in my understanding, what's been debated here, should be excluded. What we're saying is that there should be mechanisms found that the executive authority or the speakers have a mechanism to negotiate what Parliament's budget should be. The Constitution also makes provision, if the FFC wants to bring in the constitutional issues around Treasury, to say that Parliament and national provincial legislatures can pass legislation to amend a money bill. And therefore you'd have total control of budget and treasury. So if we evolve to that specific stage in our democracy, we as parliaments and legislatures will dictate to treasury how budgets are to be spent in the country. So their concern, I think, is irrelevant.
We'll deal with that one tomorrow. Don't push it, don't rush it. We're dealing with that tomorrow. But look, the bottom line here is that cutting off budgets, etc., is not just an exercise that's taken lightly. The economic situation globally is just horrible. I'm just raising this so that as we speak here, we should not speak as if cuts would never be necessary. Whether it's your legislature, whether it's a department, whatever entity has got to cut. Well, your province knows it's called tightening the belt. But we shall deal with that tomorrow, the procedure bill, amending of money bills procedure. Mr. the Accountant General, from the point of view of National Treasury.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start by introducing my colleague. I'm not sure if she's been in front of this committee already, Jeanine Bednar-Kiyose. The other treasury officials that are here are parliamentary officials, so they are well known. Thanks for this opportunity, and we hope that the input we're going to provide will not take away from the discussion, I think, that is taking place. There was a circulated a trying to save the trees 2-page presentation. I can proceed, Chair. Yeah. So I'm hoping that this will add to that process. But let me start from the onset by agreeing with the Secretary of Parliament on a very important issue that there is a sense in this legislation that says to me that we want to comply with the same set of rules. There is that sense. There are areas in the legislation, I think, where that needs to be ironed out a little bit so that it's clearer. So that is the premise from which we move. And we move from this premise not because we think Parliament is a department, not because we think Parliament ought to answer any question whatsoever from the Treasury. Because to expect that would be to expect something that is different from the nature of the constitution that we have in this country. So I think this should be understood in that light. So also the speaker made a point that I just want to quickly comment on before moving on, that it can't be correct for a legislation governed by an executive authority to direct how Parliament should be run. And I think that's the secretary, sorry. My apologies. And I think I'm not putting words in your mouth. I'm saying it exactly as it was stated, Mr. Secretary. So I think that is correct. That is absolutely correct. And to my knowledge, I do not think there is any legislation already in this country that directs how Parliament should be run. And I don't think we should allow that to happen at any point. The PFMA doesn't attempt to do that. What the PFMA seeks to do is captured very eloquently even in this legislation in the first, before you go to section one, where there's those three bullet points about the objectives of this legislation. That's what PFMA seeks to do. So to that extent, it seems to me when we got down to drafting this legislation, we're trying to achieve exactly the same objective that is in the PFMA, except to the extent that we want to ensure that the status of Parliament is recognized appropriately. So, if you can go to the first slide so that I can talk to the bullet points, otherwise I might end up digressing. The first point I think here is that the independence of the legislature or legislative sector cannot be compromised by similar norms and standards. And I think that's a point of agreement, given the input that the Secretary provided. Having said that, we should recognize that the Constitution applies to Parliament as well. Forget the PFMA. And in the Constitution, we have in Section 195 a set of values that we want every institution that has got access to public money to follow. Every institution that is the lifeblood of our democracy should follow. And then when you go to Chapter 13, which then deals with the issues of managing the resources at our disposal, we then find specific provisions and we find issues of equity dealt with there. In Section 13, it talks about one national revenue fund, and there are implications of that when you then come up with other pieces of legislation. And the implications of this go at the core of what has been discussed just recently.
live in a universe that has got limited resources, as a country, as a world at large. And limited resources, therefore, mean that not because parliament and government departments are the same, and I want to make that point up front, not because they are the same, they are not the same, they cannot be the same. The level of importance cannot be the same. But to the extent that the resources are limited, it therefore means that every institution that must get access to those resources is in fact competing for those resources. But the question that in my mind is arising here and keeps coming up in the discussion seems to talk to the process that gets followed to arrive at what the allocation for Parliament is. And there seems to be an issue that process, as it is at the moment, isn't the right process. And in fact, that is the process that must be resolved. Now, in dealing with this process and in dealing with the issue of the status of Parliament and the legislative sector as a whole, one then needs to ask the question, do you need to express that through a separate piece of legislation necessarily? And that's a question that ought to be examined on its own. And it appears to us that you could actually meet those objectives without necessarily coming with a separate piece of legislation. But be that as it may, the process has gone to the point where it is, and the NCOP needs to make its decision in relation to that. And this question of limited resources then takes us to a question where the issues of oversight and so on of Parliament over other spending agencies is critical. And I ask myself a question, and this relates to the issues where budgets are cut and so on. And dealing with this question of striking the balance in allocating the resources both to Parliament and the rest of government. Now, if we want to inculcate a democratic culture, we want to inculcate a culture of accountability, we want to inculcate a culture of transparency, it should then be possible to ask of ourselves, and in this case I'm saying ask of ourselves as the legislative sector, the same questions we're going to be asking people that are coming to account to us. The mechanism can be created, and the Secretary spoke to that. And I think that can be created, and it needs to be addressed. But we need to be able to ask those questions so that we can stand on a moral high ground when we call departments to account, when we call spending agencies to account, when we call entities to account. And I think that's an important issue that we need to think about. So when it comes to the resources that are available, it appears to me that there will have to be an approach that says, that recognizes the importance of Parliament in our democracy, but also that recognizes the fact that there is also other needs, and there has to be a manner in which this matter gets dealt with between either the Minister of Finance or Mincombat and a structure that Parliament has, in this case, for instance, the presiding officers could be the structure that would deal with that. So it is important, because resources are limited, that we have that process that allows for that interaction so that we can then have an equitable share across the board, which the Constitution requires. And in addressing that, in my mind, I don't think that you necessarily need a separate piece of legislation. But if you've got a separate piece of legislation, you then need to address that issue, because it's not going to go away. And as it stands at the moment, I don't think the bill deals with that issue properly. So there needs to be consideration given to that issue before the bill gets passed. The other issues, and these are the only two issues that I want to go specifically in the bill. There's a few other items in the bill, other clauses that can be improved so that it eliminates inconsistencies. Before I do that, let me just deal with the issues of the implications on Parliament, because in this bill, we are not making reference to the legislatures, the provincial legislatures. The way I read the bill, it's applicable to Parliament. It then has a schedule with norms and standards that are applicable to legislatures, and I want to talk to that structure. What this implies is that provincial legislatures must come up with their own legislation. I think that's the understanding that I have, and if that understanding is inaccurate, I will beg for a pardon up front. Now, and I will pick up a point in this legislation that is likely to happen then when you've got the provincial legislatures coming up with their own legislation. In this legislation, for instance, there is a definition of unauthorized expenditure. There is a clause that deals with environment. And to some degree, these definitions aren't quite the same, and these provisions aren't quite the same as in the PFMA. And the problem with the one on environment on clause 22 is that it allows the movement of funds for the funds, and this is clause, it's a paragraph A of that clause, it allows for the movement of funds, even those funds that are specifically and exclusively appropriated. Now the question that we ask, and this is to ensure that the bill doesn't have any problems with it, is that if you have a specific appropriation, an exclusive appropriation, if you take money and allocate it for a specific purpose, and specify that in the Appropriation Act, why would you then allow the executive authority to change the decision of Parliament? Because the appropriation is a voice of Parliament. The Appropriation Act is a voice of Parliament. So why take the collective voice for a specific appropriation and allow that voice to be varied by the executive authority? And that's an issue that ought to be sorted out. Parliament is meant for flexibility because you cannot foresee everything. But the general appropriations are the ones that you can utilize for parliament, not specific appropriations. I don't think the intention is to do that in the legislation. It might just be an oversight, and I think it's an issue that ought to be sorted out. There is another part in the legislation that I think we need to think about, where we deal with the prohibition to borrow money. I think it's clause 28. We are not allowing Parliament to be able to enter into a finance lease. We are not allowing Parliament to be able to utilize the mechanism of PPPs to execute some of its functions. Now, or some of the administrative issues that need to be executed. That problem, that will lead to a problem where, should you then do that and enter into a transaction in the course of your activities, you will find yourself having to answer to the auditors that the mechanism you've used to execute that is not in line with the legislation. So already you legislate to have a qualification, and I don't think that is the intention. And we need to also. Sort that one out. You can go to the next slide, please. Now, what we see as practical difficulties is that from a regulation point of view, and here regulating the administration of resources, not regulating the activities that you undertake. The activities that you undertake as Parliament, there's nobody that can tell you what to do in that. Parliament has to decide on those things. But in undertaking those activities, you employ resources. Now, in regulating the manner in which these resources are managed and employed, it becomes important that we have consistency, as the Secretary has already said. And there is a possibility, and when you look in some of the provisions, some of the clauses, there is just that possibility, that interpretation might go the other way, whereas it goes the other way in the other legislation. So it's important that we sort that out. For instance, the secretary has a responsibility to finalize the financial statements within 5 months. But then the secretary at the end of that 5 months should give these financial statements to the executive authority. And the executive authority has got 5 days to table. But then an equivalent of Section 65 of the PFMA further down requires that if there is no tabling done within 5 months, now the 5 days goes away. If I repeat, the secretary has got 5 months to submit financial statements, and the executive authority has got an additional 5 days over that 5 months, right? So 5 days, 5 months, you must have tabled. But the provision that deals with tabling does not take into account that 5 days. It just says 5 months only. And that is a technical correction that must be. There's a few others which are like that I don't think I need to bore the committee with them. So we need to sort those out, and those that can create the problems in as far as the norms and standards that are applicable are concerned. The issue of the fragmented legislation when you go to the provinces, if provinces are going to come up with their own different drafters, in interaction with lawyers, I've picked this up. Different drafters have got different drafting styles. That's why this legislation, if you read it, it's got a feel and a flow that is different from the PFMA, although the substance is the same. So different drafters come up with different flavor to their drafting, and sometimes that different flavor in drafting can result in substantive differences in the legislation. So with my understanding as it stands now, which says that we are likely to have provinces coming up with their own legislation, so we are likely to come up with potential fragmentation in the regulation of exactly the same thing, how public funds are being managed. So I think it's a point that we need to think about. There is a question, and the third point here, I need to phrase it differently because I don't think it was phrased correctly here. In the National Assembly side of government, in the cabinet side of government, I want to make sure that I'm using the right term, executive branch of government, you've got public entities, your ESCOM, your all of those entities, that report directly to specific departments. And the Public Finance Management Act specifically includes these entities in Section 3. Now, to raise the question that the Deputy Chair of the Fiscal Commission raised differently, is that, is there no need for us to think about constitutional institutions, the Chapter 9 institutions, in terms of whether should they then apply to the PFMA or should they be applying the same piece of legislation that Parliament is applying? It's a question. Shouldn't we be thinking about that as well? In other words, we're potentially creating another gap, because then those institutions might just be misplaced where they would be applicable, where the PFMA would be applicable to them. And not in this legislation. So this is something that we need to think about. We had, you can move on to the next slide. We had thought that an alternative approach here is to recognize everything that I said in the beginning, that Parliament ought to be accorded the status it deserves, the process of the allocation to Parliament, while having regard to the limited nature of resources, ought to be looked at differently, and a process that is in line with the status of Parliament and the issues raised is taken into account, but capture those in the same legislation. In the same legislation that the government agencies apply, but make sure that the provisions that relate to Parliament are very, very clear. The oversight processes relating to Parliament are very, very clear. PFMA is very silent to that effect at the moment. It only says that in Section 3 that process will go to the Speaker. But there's a lot of other issues that the Secretary spoke about that you need to think about from an oversight from oversight point of view that are not catered for in the current PFMA. In fact, the review of the PFMA became necessary in 2000 already when the Speaker, Secretary of Parliament raised the question about the applicability of the PFMA and then suggested that maybe you need a separate legislation or you need to review the PFMA. So the need arose much earlier in the implementation of the PFMA and the need is still there. So this was the very first reason why PFMA had to be amended, and there's other reasons after the implementation of the PFMA. So maybe there needs to be a way in which you capture these in that piece of legislation and ensure that you actually make a clear distinction in that legislation on how the parliamentary issues can be dealt with. But you then have the same set of rules applicable to everybody, and then there will be no other questions. And the potential fragmentation that can result from other legislatures coming up with their own legislations can be subverted. So, Chair, in conclusion, if you can go to the last slide, we're saying that the constitutional issues of relationship between National Treasury and the questionable role of Parliament and in its independence are important, they are critical, we ought to think about them, we ought to make sure that that is not compromised, and we ought to find the best vehicle to do that. If the committee thinks the separate piece of legislation is that vehicle, then I think we can live with that decision of the committee. The issues of alignment are critical. Now, with the different drafter drafting the legislation, we need to be very, very careful in the specific wording of the different clauses that we don't lose out certain things. For instance, there's one clause where the subject to is put on a part, and we'll make the specific points straight. We'll make the written points straight to that, because it's important that those things are there. The subject to a particular clause is put on a sub clause that is not, where it's not really relevant, but where it's relevant, it's just above that clause, which could have been, again, just something being lost in translation there. So that alignment is absolutely critical, not just in broad things, but also in the specific provisions. We need to make sure that alignment is created. The fragmentation of regulation, we need to think about that quite seriously, particularly in respect to the provincial legislatures. The determination of the amount to be appropriate to Parliament, I think we need to find a process that can deal with that, because I mean it will always be a debatable issue. And I'm saying, in the context of limited resources, we think Parliament as well as the rest of government ought to think about that issue quite seriously in terms of how it gets addressed, so that we achieve the principle of equity that is envisaged in the Constitution. So, Chair, I think our view is that we respect the decision that has been taken, but we do have issues that we think that we need to think about seriously. If we go down that route, we need to then make certain adjustments so that we do not have any things that are falling in between the chairs. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the Treasurer. See, speaking last has advantages and disadvantages, in that some of the things that you're raising might have been raised and discussed over and over again, but you have your submission, you have got to make them maybe in your own what you call a way. I'm saying this because the main class of the what you call a submission of Treasurer to me is that of one piece of legislation rather than a separate legislation for Parliament. And I think that we have
maybe indirectly what we call a refer to this issue of whether we really need a separate piece of legislation or what. I mean, the issues that are being raised, issues of accountability, is the road that we have really what you call traveled. Is the issue of separate pieces of pieces of legislation as each province does its own what you call it thing. But what perhaps I thought that National Treasurer would raise from then is that National Treasurer has been aware of this process of coming up with this legislation. I don't know then what homework has been done. For instance, the secretary was saying there are experiences elsewhere. Has National Treasurer parents looked into those kind of things, that where there are experiences and how parents those matters have been regulated? Because I think that it would be useful to say that, I mean, to make reference to those experiences. We are part of this a global village. But the other issue, Chair, just to be a devil's advocate, you know,
is this a review of the PFMA?
I think that with respect, there has been this review for the past 5 years that I've been here in Parliament, but I have not really seen it happening practically. I'm not sure whether perhaps it has been delayed by this process or what, because maybe if, as Nashar Sura says, they have seen the need from 2000, there has been amendments, but there has been talk of a the reviewal of the whole what you call legislation. It has also delayed perhaps as well, because maybe it would assist us on this matter. So, Chairperson, I'm just saying that I mean, there are issues that National Treasury is raising that have not been raised. I don't know if we could go back to the last what you call it slide, you know, especially with the, if I could get clarity of this last bullet, you know, that if this kind of legislation is part, the exclusions that are made and whether in this legislation there are perhaps proposals to of the same. Yeah, I think that these are the areas that one would like to raise with National Treasury. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Oh. Thanks, JJ. Just maybe on that second last bullet, does the Accountant General refer there to to what is commonly known in our circles as that top slice effect before you start with appropriation for departments? Then you look at your parliament as well as your legislature, and you set aside top slice, and after that you appropriate. Is my understanding correct if that is the referral to that specific thing? Thanks, Jay.
Secretary of Parliament, anything?
No, just as a point of emphasis, the point that Mr. Nodia raises is what is raised in that policy document that I referred the committee to, the 14-page document. But it specifically says that when the branch of government and parliament meets, they must look at the top slice portion of budget when you deal with parliament, before you deal with all other entities of state. That policy document says that, just to support the point made by Mr. Nodia.
I think what we must do, if it's fine with you, Secretary, just to be able to get copies of that today, if it's possible. Tomorrow, where are we meeting tomorrow? So that we receive them tomorrow or today, because they must be part and parcel of our briefing notes on Thursday and Friday, because without really also involving that document, we're going to be missing this gap as we talk, because let's also look at that. Okay. Hello, sir.
Sorry, just before you close, I thought that...
Not closing. I was still proceeding.
That's before you refer it back to...
No, not refer back. The member here from Limpopo is talking.
Hey, this is Deputy Chairperson. Okay.
Thanks, Chairperson, yes. Just following up on your request, this so-called 48-page document. 14. Thanks. If it could also be sent to provinces, so that when we deal with this thing at law provinces, we're a bit wiser. But secondly also, this question keeps on coming up time and again, the Secretary doesn't respond to it. I assumed when they were drafting this bill, they could have also gone to read what are other practices in some other areas elsewhere. Can we also be furnished with a document that tells us how are the other countries or parliaments dealing with this type of abuse we're dealing with now? If they could also fax that document to us to make us a bit wiser. Thanks, Chair.
No, we want to travel and go to these places. We must go and do research, Mr. Von Fall says. It means before we pass this one, we have to have treat. So we have to, don't give us notes. Allow us to travel and engage with questions. Just tell us which countries to go to. We will decide to go to those countries ourselves. No, look, I think they've said it's critical. You see, because we can't do this really without understanding. So we've got to speak to everybody. The Secretary is going to give us part of the budget. In fact, of us, I was checking with Trevor, she says we still have money. And so we surely have to go. You see, because really, we can't deal with this. It's a big thing. So we must have an understanding that says in this parliament, in this country, etc. And so, part of our program must also take that into account. 3-4 days of overseas trip. So good.
Thank you very much. I thought that you have a big alliance with Ntate Thobejane, but it's not so slightly different.
I'm saying the other part, maybe that I thought the Secretary would comment about, is this issue of separate article legislation for provinces. I know that we're going to go on Friday to provinces with those concerns, but we would like just to hear from us that why do we envisage a separate piece of pieces of legislation, each one having its own article. I thought that he would just make a comment on that comment. Thank you.
He decided to not to. Mr. Numbal.
Thank you, Chair. I think on the first question of the comparisons elsewhere, when we are working on the public finance measure, we do make the comparisons, but to the extent that the issues of parliament
Parliament specifically are dealt with. I cannot make a specific comment on that, but I know that the colleagues that I've been working with. Okay. So can I leave that to the committee? Thank you. The review of the PFMA, yes, has been on the cards for some time. There were specific issues. For instance, there were issues relating to management of public entities that had to be sorted out that resulted in some of the delays. When this process started, we also wanted the PFMA to go through the same time. And it went through the cabinet process last year and in fact got approved by cabinet but missed the final document missed the parliamentary process by a day or two. And we tried, and there were processes in cabinet that resulted in that. And we couldn't get the PFMA through that process. It is obviously being prioritized to go through. It would have been part of the consideration as we speak. That has been the intention of the Treasury. So the reason we haven't seen it is because once it was approved by the cabinet process, the parliamentary it was too late for the parliamentary process for the PFMA review to go through. But it will be following suit. Just after the elections. The issue on the last bullet, if you could the issue of the last bullet is an issue that this bill attempts to deal with in clause 28, and I made reference to it that you've got section 66 of the old PFM, section 66 and 67 that deals with these issues, and then you've got clause 28 in this one. But there is an issue of an alignment here, particularly when it relates to what we've done through the Treasury regulations on finance leases and PPPs, that needs to be taken into account, which could potentially result in difficulties where an unnecessary qualification in the financial statements of Parliament would result. And that is the issue that still remains. In as far as that point is concerned, and of course ensuring that the provisions as they are there, they align properly with the rest of the provisions in the PFMA as well as because that flows from a constitutional imperative as well. The second last bullet is not questioning the principle of TOPS slicing. When you read it, it's not questioning whether you should TOPS slice or not. What it's saying is that when you have to top slice, there has to be an amount to be top sliced. So it is that amount that becomes a question. And of course, the sentiment that I heard from the members is the question. You need to adequately resource Parliament so that it carries out its mandates. And I make the statement that we live in a universe with limited resources. So while trying to do that, while trying to make sure that you've got adequate resources for Parliament and the legislative sector, the statement, the sentence doesn't end there. The statement goes further to say you have to make sure that you adequately resource Parliament and the legislative sector, given the limited resources. And therefore that means that you need to find a mechanism of arriving at what amount should be top sliced each year. So that question of the process that must be followed, that allows for the status of Parliament to be accorded and the question of limited resources to be considered appropriately. So that is the point here. Not whether you should top slice or not. I think the principle that was agreed a few years ago is a principle that is not being questioned. But how do you arrive at that amount? I think is the key issue that has been a source of heated debate in the provinces and nationally to some degree. Thank you.
See, this discussion has got to be a bit broader because when you deal with the provincial allocations in the context of the equitable share, the split there is clear. 85% social sector, and therefore the rest goes to every other. Again, competition is tight. It's the world of the meltdown. And so how do we deal with that? In other words, it means we've got to have a much broader discussion. question about all of these allocations. Because clearly as things stand now, the formula is just 85% social sector. And every other thing, economic sector, what have you, must then deal with the 15% in the provinces. And so how do we resolve the matter of adequately funding now provincial legislatures, if you like? But another bigger discussion is necessary, because we can't just get into that discussion willy-nilly. Issues of efficiencies, effectiveness, economy also apply. If you look at some of the provincial budgets, you can see terrible pictures. I'm not going to tell you the stories now. If you want the stories, we can take you through that journey, not today. It's a terrible picture. And so as we just talk, we should not talk as if, well, money is readily available. It would be nice to have it readily available anyway. So we work within the environment that also says, the Constitution says, government must provide within these limited resources all of these services. Now, I think the discussion was a bit useful today, but there still is a matter which, some of these matters we must start resolving. Not all of them are going to be resolved immediately. The issues of research means we've got to go out and see how these things are done in Uganda, in Zimbabwe, in Russia, in the USA, in Canada. I'm just saying, yes. No, I'm just adding some. So we might want to go there, but that's the one thing. But secondly, just for now, on the 17th, we're having negotiating mandates. I don't want to ask the Secretary just to study the submission of the Auditor General's office. We have not dealt with it today, they are not here. And just to hear what the comments would be in respect of what the Auditor General's office is saying, so that we also deal with that in terms of the matters that must be dealt with. Then I'm coming to you. I do want us to resolve this one matter. It must not remain unresolved, because you don't want to come back to it 10 years down the line. As Mr. Sokoni was saying, you picked this thing up, it was not done. We don't want to say the judiciary, and then it does come back. Finally, let's be clear and say, as we do these things, how do we deal with this matter? I do want the Secretary and my state law advisor now to start looking at this one. How do we approach this matter? We're not saying the judiciary must wake up and deal with it, but we're saying, in the context of passing legislation as Parliament, having foreseen this thing, how do we deal with it now so that it does not come back to haunt us in future? We could have done a comprehensive engagement in terms of this thing. How do we deal with this thing? But also the FFC says, how do you deal with this opportunity so that you don't lose the opportunity as you move forward in terms of this matter? Part of the big issue is that the Public Finance Management Act was passed by this Parliament. And so, why is it that this Parliament is not promoting and defending the Public Finance Management Act? not to be held accountable on the basis of the principles of the Public Finance Management Act. Why would we pass pieces of legislation that we don't promote and defend? Enhance them if we want, in the sense that we must also lead by example, also be seen to be held accountable on the basis of the pieces of legislation that we have passed ourselves as Parliament. I'm just throwing this one for consideration. It's a very critical matter. The gaps that must be dealt with in respect of the provinces, it's a matter that we must look into. Part of what we did say in the last meeting, it's something that you might want to start with. In fact, it's something when we discuss it, it's something that we will come back to, Mr. Jenkins. We're not going to discuss before now because members have said let's not concretize some of the matters. But let's then ensure that all of the submissions that are before us now, at least, inclusive of the 14-point policy document, are given to all of us so that we go back and brief people appropriately, and then, on the basis of that, discuss all of the issues that are before us. Now, I've seen four or five hands that were raised quickly. Madam Robinson Kunu.
Thank you, Chair. Just briefly, there seems to be so much uncertainty about this. If there has to be wider research, we've got to do all sorts of other things, how can we do briefings? We've got no answers. Is this going to be delayed then?
No, it's not delayed, Madam Robinson. For now, let's brief provinces on these matters. They might also assist in terms of their own wisdom. But clearly, let's brief them also, because it means we are all moving at one pace. Let's not leave... If we've got to do research, it means all of us must engage with this kind of research. Let's brief them now, at least. There is some clarity in terms of some of the issues that have been raised in terms of the documents now. If we've got to go and do further research, we will have to do that. Okay? And I'm done.
Yes. Well, I agree with you in that fashion. You know, there's a pity that the Auditor General is not here. And also this one of... I just get it quickly. And then one of the David Alistair Chambers. Yeah. You know, Chair, what I found there is very interesting to brief this committee, because there's a part, if we had to brief the provinces, we had to also take that in consideration. And also what the Secretary said, that 14-page document. Chair, I don't know, time is from the law of essence. But is there no time for a 2 hour somewhere where the Secretary, the Chamber and the Auditor General can also brief us committee in regarding of this process? Because if I just take one aspect and I don't want to go back, or the Auditor General, they said it is unclear how party will be obtained on a provincial level. You know, Chair, there's the Auditor General saying that. So this is very, very important. And also on page 4 of that legal people, I mean, we're not playing with a small thing. We're talking about deep things of the Constitutional Court. What they've said on page 4 here is in regarding the treasury and everything, the legal aspects of that. Some of these issues, if you're not... handled correctly, that can be create big problems. That can be the constitution had to change. If you take it really in consideration, this act. So, Chair, I would like before that 17th when we go or the briefing, if we can find yes an hour or hour and a half. Yes, for a briefing for us, that we also can understand what they say, that we can take it over to the provinces. to let they can understand also what other people say, because we hear today here what is the views here, but that too is really, really interesting and essential, because that order the general, he's the end of the day who said you make a mistake or you do that. Thank you.
Jay, I'm just concerned that we don't put the cart in front of the horse. Thank you, Jay.
You see, you're raising a complicated one, Mtan, which is absolutely right. I mean, between now and Thursday and Friday, I entirely agree with. If we would be able to get the Auditor General's office, for instance, it would have been nice, but now, if we're not able to, in fact, let's try and get them.
Okay. But we have to go and brief the provinces, and then they must send us a mandate. On this moment, that there's two members of Limpopo, and Eastern Cape, another member from other province, what mandate can we send it to this committee? To negotiate what? That's my question, Chair. There's nothing wrong to go and brief the provinces. Those who are not here, but members have to go to brief the provinces. But we have to brief them what? And then they must send us a mandate for negotiating. For what? And that is my question, Chair. What mandate will they give us now? I can tell you my province, and I'm sure regarding the lot of questions, they will say, we can't give you any mandate now to negotiate for what? Because we agree now that we had to go investigate more, perhaps visit the country. But because they can't give this Limpopo province, I don't think, and this chairperson of administration there, Comrade Tobajani, can he give us a mandate to negotiate for what? Or a final mandate in regard? I'm asking the question here, as my comrade said, did we not jump the gun or put the horse in front of the horses? I'm not so sure, Chair, to negotiate for what? A mandate for what? And they must answer that question, and that we can come to a point to say where we are going.
Look, I think let's have a mandate of complicating this thing further. I mean, listening to these inputs, it's becoming complicated. And that is basically the point. I mean, listening to National Treasure, they're raising more questions. The FFC raised some questions. The Auditor General raises some questions. Now, I'm saying let's have a mandate to be much more, to problematize this issue. Because finally it must be resolved. It must be resolved, finally. You see, because the point is, we can't just now move and say, well, here it is. But there are two options. One is to say, rubber stamp. The second one is, this one that says, we must be 100% clear about this. And so I'm saying, let also provinces look at this and say, but there's some, maybe that, you see, for instance, part of what we have not yet done in today's discussion is to look at the provincial specific details, which surely would be coming out of the provinces. The provinces would be saying, there is this thing that is not there, there is this thing that is not there, there is this thing that is not there. In other words, as we come back with negotiating mandates, we are bringing all of those angles, mindful of exactly this matter that you are saying, that look, there are unresolved matters that we say need further research, because as we brief you, we also are not aware of similar experiences across the globe. And so clearly we've got to find a way of saying all of us in one voice. I was saying earlier, for instance, if you listen to speakers say they are ready to do this thing anytime, any day. Now the legislators might be having a different view now, because maybe all along legislators also speakers were thinking. But when you start briefing them and say, but these are the issues that are coming up, they might also then show you other angles that are not raised here. I'm saying as provinces now. And so clearly, we might then bring again a comprehensive view from the point of view of the negotiating mandates, basically. So clearly for us, it's again getting more information from provinces on the basis of these things are problematic. And maybe your provinces might also say, well, do we need this or do we need that? And these are some of the discussions we want to engage with in the provinces. Do we take the schedule? Do we need a chapter on provinces? Do we say, no, away with this? Let's go the route of the review of the PFMA. Provinces might also advise. I'm saying, it means we might also say, no, why the rush? Provinces might also tell us, no, we are in the midst of an election. Why are you rushing? I'm just saying, these are some of the things we might want to get from provinces. Mr. Venfor, I'm coming off.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. It's just unfortunate there's been a delay, to put it in a nice way, in terms of dealing with this bill. But we can't pretend that there was some kind of a standoff between Treasurer and Parliament in terms of how we view in terms of dealing with this legislation and so on, as issues were being prepared and processed. But one would like to also believe this matter has been subject for discussion through the Speaker's Forum at some other point and so on. I just don't know to what extent. But then the question will also be there in terms of engagement of provincial treasuries around that issue and so on. It will be difficult of us now to preempt what outcome will be coming from provinces and staff with regard to this. But it's one piece of legislation which we find ourselves kind of pressured with time constraints and so on. Elections are just around the corner. It's one piece of legislation you can't also say, because it has met its deadline and identified as one priority legislation to be passed before the end of the term of this parliament. We can't shift it as much as we can like to shift unspent funds to the next parliament. We can't shift this bill. We'll have to finalize it. I was just putting that on a lighter note. So the issue we will have to say, given the time we have, we'll have to try to also do justice, because at times it's that great haste make great waste. How do you balance in between that and so on, so that you also don't miss input of important stakeholders in the process as you are doing it. One way of that will be to say, like there have been more questions, if I was listening to the submissions, there have been more questions than solutions to those questions. Classical one, the one which was raised as the second last bullet, the determination and so on of whether you speak about an X amount or percentage. Because personally, I will not say let's go to put an amount. You can have a formula of how we deal with that. It might help your committee chairperson to request the secretary to, in the meantime, be making a submission around that, and also treasurer to say how do we deal with those kind of things, so that by the time possibly we come for the negotiating mandates, no, by the time provincial legislatures go for their public hearings, at least they have got those proposals which they can converse and lobby around their stakeholders at that level, to allow a situation that as we get the negotiating mandates, it should have also encompassed that particular kind of information. I think it's one way which can try to assist us and so on. In terms of getting experiences from outside the country, it's not necessarily that the committee will have to really go out, otherwise we might end up going beyond the date of the elections by the time you come back. But I think we can be given our research capacity to say which countries, nearly in terms of the constitutional dispensation, mirror South Africa. Then you identify them in priority to say country A, B, C, and D. But as much as would have liked to go to 15 countries, given the time, can't we just zoom into those countries and get those particular experiences? Then we put them into our process as we move forward. Thank you, Chair.
You know, Chair, the Auditor General is a big stakeholder in this. And I'm going to read that sentence for sentence. Norms and standards for provincial legislation. This bill is only applicable to the National Parliament. It appears that provinces must enact legislation for the financial management of provisional legislatures. Broad norms and standards for inclusion in provincial statutes are included in Schedule 1 to the bill. The last sentence, Chair, is, it is unclear how parity with this bill will be obtained on a provincial level. And, Chair, this isn't from Marius Robertson or Tutu Khalani. This is the Auditor General. And I think we must pay attention to it, Chair. Thank you.
Chair, that's why I'm asking, what is the possibility, urgently, that we can get the Auditor General and the state, the chamber, that too, that they come and present, and perhaps that 14-page policy document, because to read it and to present it is two things. That's the start of question, Chair. And I know time is of a limited, but if we had to do that, we had to do that.
You see, this one would be a bit difficult. He's a senior counsel. I'm not sure how soon we can get him. And surely it would cost something just for him to drive here and so on and so on. That's one area. I'm not sure. I don't think it would be very difficult to get the Auditor General. We can ask the Accountant General also just to find a way of ensuring that we get the Auditor General. But I'm just worried about this other gentleman, because part of what we intended to do, you see, part of this other legal opinion, in fact this legal opinion was focusing only on one aspect, the constitutionality of the law. But then it did not include this other aspect of the judiciary. And so we might also want, and this is why I had to call in the state law advisor as a quick measure, because it means at least he can move with speed, his office can move with speed. Now, going this route would mean we must also write a letter and so on and so on, asking for money for the legal opinion. And I'm not sure how much the legal opinion would cost. Now, how much was this opinion, Mr. Jenkins?
If I remember correctly, it wasn't the most expensive, but we paid close to between 20,000 and 30,000 for it, if I'm not mistaken. I can find out to get the exact amount from the Portfolio Committee.
Just find out, because what we might want to do is, because what they also did, Mr. Porter, they did not even appear before the committee. They just sent the legal opinion to the committee, portfolio committee. And so it means if we'd want to have him also appear before us, taking us through, that would be another cost. And so just the whole cost, if you can look at that, so that he does the whole thing and just brief us and take us through. And they charge on the basis of an hour, etc., etc. So I'm saying that's one aspect that's a bit difficult for now. Let's allow me
there. But Jay, if the state, local state legal advisor can go through that, and he can go through that issue with us, page by page, and indicated the legal aspects in regarding of that, then I'm happy with that.
No, let me just check, therefore. Do you think tomorrow we're having a meeting here on the procedure, financial management procedure? Can we then ask you to go take us through this one, this legal opinion, tomorrow?
Thank you, Chair. I can just have some clarity on the instruction with regard to presenting the opinion which was drafted by the senior counsel on this matter. Not our views, but his views as such. I'm sure anyone...
Another problem, Mumtan. Because he's just going to present somebody's views. It's problematic. Let's not do it for now. When we come back to this one, maybe on the 17, let's find a way of trying to get them. The Auditor General, we've got to try and find, if possible, tomorrow, Auditor General's office, and then just so that those views of the Auditor General are looked into properly, and what is it that they are exactly implying. Then the Secretary of Parliament also wanted to say his last words. He's not on death row.
No, very soon. And I wanted to clarify the issue around provinces that Mr. Venfor referred to, that indeed this bill has been discussed or was discussed for a very long time in the Speaker's Forum. And the agreement there was that it doesn't have to be directive, but the framework legislation, so that provinces should go back and draw up their own legislation using this as a framework. I think it's important to make that point. I hope that, Chair, that the speakers of the legislatures indeed were representing the views of the legislatures in that regard. So if that is true, you'd find that even when you go to the legislatures, in addition to other new things, that there is broader support for the bill. It might be that there would be a need to change here and there because of the new questions which have been raised by different people. Thanks, sir.
On that note, lunch is ready somewhere in a dining hall here. Mark's building, yes. I hear people want to change the name. Well, it's not yet changed. It's still Mark's for now. Everybody is invited to lunch. Thank you for your inputs.